Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I've heard a lot about the things that are being done with legislation and making sure that states and countries ban corporal punishment and things of that nature. But if you do not go and talk to the mother or the father about their innate views and their innate feelings about children, you can pass all the laws you want, but you're not changing the fiber of the society. The laws will be changed overnight if you have a rally of parents to back it. But the reason you don't have a rally of parents to back it is because they still have these deep-seated feelings of resentment towards kids or whatever they were raised with. I was beaten and it made me turn out better. You know, they have that belief. So if that's what has to be attacked, that's what has to be handled, is the fact that they actually believe that they deserve the beatings. And that they're going to give more beatings because it made them better. My approach is to attack the pain, not in a way that's like evaluative. Let's look at that. I don't care about that. Nobody wants to feel like that, like they're being researched. I'm talking about, did it work for you? When I do my workshops, I have people actually look at their first exposure to violence. And I have them draw what their first exposure to violence is. And you'd be very surprised what they come up with. And when they look at it themselves, see, they blocked it out for so many years, to return to it and see it, they don't like it. And so then I have them address, well, what would have been better? And then they conjure up the better things. And after that, they go, oh, and they don't want to do those things anymore. One lady said to me in a workshop, thank you for letting us tell our stories because no one ever asks us. That was like amazing. She's a parent. Nobody ever asks. They just want to condemn the parents for what they're doing. But you're not asking them the questions that will help you see why they're doing it. It's like you want to answer, but you're not really asking the questions to get the answer. You're just condemning people for their actions. But when you really listen to these people, you know why they do it. And then you know how to fix it. It's that simple.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. So I have been told. We will be back in 2 days. The Book Study Club will have more details on that as we get rolling. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported us. 7 years, hopefully, constructive information for all the folks who have invested their time and energy. Before we get started, Again, just want to have a moment to recognize the, it's just been a very tough year for the Kress family. Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, her transition right at the beginning of the new year, and then her other sister, Barbara Kress Lawrence, she transitioned this past weekend. Lauren Kress Love, she was on the program just in the past 2 weeks. And she talked about the health problems that her other sister was having, and just it's been a very tough year. So just a pause to send some great energy, thoughts, prayers to the Kress family and everything that they have endured thus far this year. I hope they are taking great care of themselves, and hopefully we'll have programs coming up in the future. If folks are looking for ways that they can contribute and help in their time of need, we can find out ways that folks can do that. But just a quick moment of silence for the Kress family. Context of white supremacy, and appropriate for today because I spoke with Lauren Kress Love before she was a guest on our program, and she highly recommended our guest for today's program. She had just huge reviews, glowing commentary about her work. I recommended getting her a book and doing all that we could to try to get her on the program immediately, and I was able to follow up on that as soon as I got her book in hand to see if we could get her on the program, and she was willing to come and speak with us. She did a lot of interviews, television, radio in 2014 when the Adrian Peterson controversy, if folks remember, he is a black male football player, and he got into a lot of trouble. Even there were criminal charges with regards to him beating his black son. And people, this raised the whole issue of corporal punishment, and is it ever acceptable to beat a child and call that discipline? She did a lot of just fantastic interviews. You can find a lot of commentary on YouTube. You can go to her webpage. It's linked in the description for the program. The book that we are going to discuss, phenomenal material. It's Beating Black Kids, So What Have You Been Beat With? Just outstanding material. I would really encourage folks to get a copy of the book. If you are a parent, if you are contemplating having children, just has a lot of fantastic techniques that you can think about, process, even the importance of words. And you know, that's something we definitely pay attention to on this program. You can go to the website, which is the same title as the book, BeatingBlackKids.com. As I said, it's linked in the description for the program. Should be on our Facebook page as well. The address again is Beating Black Kids. In addition to being an author, she is a mother, an educator with more than two decades of experience, and utilizing these strategies to just prepare outstanding young children to go out and have lots of confidence and feel like they have been appreciated and loved. Real pleasure to have her on the program. Joining us live, our guest joining us from Chicago, Miss Asada Kirkland. Miss Kirkland, you're with us?
I am so with you. How are you, Brother Gus?
I am doing well and glad that you could join us this evening. Really glad to have you on the program. For our listeners, this might be their first time hearing about you and your work. Anything that you would like to share with our listeners before we get started?
Yeah, first I would want to say that was such a phenomenal introduction. I think I'm going to hire you right off the spot. I'm like, whoa, he is fellow. This is a fabulous introduction. So I just want to say thank you for that because you really gave people a good sense of, I don't really have much more to say other than what you said. So just thank you for that. I appreciate you.
Oh, for sure. BeatingBlackKids.com. And I really could have just repeated. I really did just repeat a lot of the things that Lauren Kress Love had to say about you when we spoke. So, again, my much appreciation for Lauren Kress Love. Before we get into the book, just for folks who haven't seen you, you are a black female. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm a sister. I tell, you know, my brothers from the continent. Or the Caribbean, because I wear African clothes, hair wrap and stuff. So they always go, are you Jamaican or where are you from? And I just said, I'm one of those stolen kids, you know, from, I'm in New York. I reside in New York. I'm one of them stolen kids, one of the descendants of the stolen ones. So then they go, oh, you know, so yeah, native to New York, but I am in Chicago making it go right in a big way here right now.
Outstanding. This program, every time we get started, I give my definition out. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Oh, I definitely think that the system exists. There's no question about that. It's how the country we live in was built on that system. You know, it didn't exist prior to a certain group, but it definitely, the system we're in right now is a derivative of that. And I guess for me, in this moment, and I guess we'll talk more about this going forward in this interview, is knowing about it, now we do. So what do we do about it? You know, knowing that this country is nothing new, to that killing off young black folks is not a new phenomenon in this country. And we understand where it comes from. And what I want my people, what I want us to do is to make decisions on how we're going to handle the situation. And that's a story that will come down the pipe as we talk about the book and those other things. So I agree with what you said.
Right on. I guess to get started, as I already stated, you are a black mother. I think that's very important. Sometimes people are giving out advice and they don't have children. Not that they don't have quality advice sometimes, but just I think that's good for our listeners to know that this is someone who has put these techniques in practice with their own offspring. Can you tell us your daughter's name and why you chose that title?
Sure. My daughter's name is Patience, and Patience is 12 years wise. And chose the title because it just is exemplary of what's occurring. I have a lot of brothers and sisters from the Nation of Islam that will say, kids, no, you should change your title. I was just on a radio show yesterday, and somebody asked if I could change the title to Disciplining Black Children. And I said no, because that's what we're doing. We are treating them like little animals when we hit them. We're treating them like kids. We're not actually treating them like children. Treating them like kids. Like little animals when we hit them. So the title stays, and I didn't give much thought to the title in that regard, but that's sort of the tone where it comes from, this beating black kids. And I chose the title because it was very simple. I put it out there. A situation happened. I had a stroke in 2008 and was being supervised by a friend, and that meant supervision of myself and my daughter. My daughter, at the time, she ripped up some money, and the person's response was that she needed a spanking so she wouldn't do it again, which I thought was incredibly ridiculous because it just never occurred to me to hit her. And when I saw that this came from a quote-unquote progressive person, I said, is this an issue still? And I took it to work when I returned to work after the stroke and saw that even my colleagues, when I said, I think I'm going to write a book, and they said, well, what is it going to be called? And when I said beating black kids, they just went on and on and on for 3 hours straight of their own testimonies of having been hit as children. And I was like, whoa. You know, so I went and boom and got a tape recorder, take those stories, and next thing you know, in less than 6 months, I had a book out, and it's been rolling ever since.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. Great name for a child as well, Patience. Well, I guess even before I was going to get to my next question, but what was your reasoning behind naming your daughter Patience?
I honestly feel like she gave me that name because prior to her being born, I didn't know what she was going to be named. I thought it was going to be an Indian name. I didn't know what I was going to name her. But just woke up one morning and said Patience. Like, it just came out of my mouth. So she had to give me that. Like, she had to be up in my spirit, up creating that in my belly, whatever she's doing, tell me, yo, name me Patience. So I thought it was good and fitting, and it actually describes how she was in my womb. Like, I had no crazy kicking. I had no morning sickness. I had nothing. And in her sonogram, she was laying back like she was on the beach with her hands behind her head, relaxing back. And I was so amazed by it. I took pictures of it and I had it on some bookmarks for my baby shower. I was like, look at the baby. She's laying in my stomach like she's chilling on the beach. But so Patience was just exemplary of who she is and was at the time. And so is it.
Wow. Folks who listen to the program, we always end with our prayer, patient with other Black people, patient with ourselves. Mm. Very important. Mm. Very important. Do you talk to patients about racism? And if so, what does that conversation sound like?
It's so interesting because I don't necessarily have to differentiate and teach her about it because we just live it. And the standpoint that she gets, though, is not one that is reactionary. Like, I can look at my own self and my own process of consciousness. And when I first started learning about, I was about 16 years old in a leadership group in New York City, and we were trained to really be connected to the community. But what that meant was we read books by Lerone Bennett, by Ivan Van Sertima, by Frantz Fanon, by, Martin Luther King's Why We Can't Wait. Like, we read these books all prior to college. And so by the time I went to college, I was very like, what? I'm pro-Black. I have everything. Pro-Black, anti-white. I was everything. So I went to Northwestern University with that hair wrap on and them Cali shows on, and I was in there like, what? You know, they had on African clothes, and they was like, who is this little firestorm child from New York? But I watched the evolution of myself as I continued to read and continued to build and continued to grow. And I didn't deviate from that knowledge, but my handling of the knowledge became different over time. So I would say when I first began, it was very kind of, you know, white devil boom in the beginning, because that's what we read. Come on, autobiography, Malcolm X, I was rocking out, you know, and I was angry that, what, capitalism and slavery? I was angry that these things occurred. And over time, I acknowledged how to be productive and make sure that I got good results. And so my daughter comes up in a world where we're African-centered. That's just a given. You know, that's how I dress. That's how we live. So I don't have to say it because we are it. And in terms of handling the races, she has an understanding of who she is as a Black woman and the power of Black people. And so when she sees things on television that don't reflect our power, she'll say things like, she'll be watching the show, she'll say, always the brother got to go first. She'll say stuff like that. Always the brother got to die first. And I go, I know, right? Or we'll be watching Disney and, you know, they say, Easy T is coming on and the guy comes on doing hip hop and it's a little white boy. And we'll be like, what? You know, kind of like, get out of here, that type of thing. So it's not a heavy thing for her because I want her to be able to see, have a good reflection on the handling. Her power has nothing to do with that. Like, her being pro-Black has nothing to do with white people at all. It's just that you know the history, see who did what, and let that be a guide for how you make decisions and why you make decisions in favor of your people and why it's important to be proud of our people, you know, because it's come out of this experience, which is not easy. So from that standpoint, she gets it. You know, I don't have to be angry anymore about the scene.
Hmm. How do you grapple with television in your household as a parent?
Oh, man, television is just, it's just a thing. You know, you look at it and it's a way that people are illustrating their stories. It's a viewpoint that they want to have. And so I remember a point in my life where I didn't have a television. I was very anti-television and blah, blah, blah. Today in life, and even with my daughter, I don't prohibit her from any show that she wants to watch, because I think as a people, when you talk about freedom, freedom is not something you have to argue about or you have to ask people for. You just are it. And so her freedom to just learn and listen, that I really need her to feel that. Like, I think that our people, a lot of people have a thing where we prohibit our children, like, don't do this, don't do that, don't look over there, don't do. And that creates for a person who goes in life kind of like that. And I don't want that. What they need to do is just be able to discern and make decisions based on what's being shown, and then understand what they want to take in their mind or not. So sometimes she'll be speaking, and it'll be kind of a profound thought or some vocabulary that I'm like, where did you learn that from? She goes, I watch television. And I go, oh, you know, we just kind of laugh it off. But what I know as a parent is that I just make sure I double back. I have to match. I can't let the TV out. You know, that's, she's taking those messages in, but I have to make sure my messages are being taken in so that she can make proper decisions on what she's going to live by or not. So I don't really get into what not to do. We just go into negotiating or making decisions that make the best scene for you growing up.
Mm-hmm. You have a glossary in the back of Beating Black Kids, and you give a lot of attention to the importance of words and making sure that we understand words that are being mm-hmm. used. One of the most significant terms, I think, discipline. Can you kind of give some thoughts on that term?
Yeah, I love giving a definition of discipline. First off, I'm a Scientologist, and I've been one for about 14 years. And one of the, a lot of people don't understand what that is, but when you go into a Church of Scientology and take a course, because that's all you do in Scientology, you take courses on life. Like, you go to college to learn how to be a nurse or a lawyer or whatever, but then you be terrible with time management or, you know, and we don't do that. You take courses in everything so that you take courses in life. How do you raise a child? How do you handle an injury? How do you deal with time? How do you handle money, right? So one of the things in those courses you learn to do is you learn to decipher words, to what we call clear words, and there is a dictionary in the back of every book. So in the back of my book, they have to be a dictionary just for the simple fact that, you know, the word right can mean a direction, right can mean correction, right can mean, it has like four different definitions, R-I-G-H-T. And so if a person only has one of those definitions in their mind, then they won't understand the sentence that they're using in that context. So that's why the dictionary is there. But I love to define the word discipline because we use it often as a people. And I'm going to tell you right now, the culturally conscious community or the nationalist community, I was really taken aback by how much we advocated still hitting children. Even though we talk about pyramids and got on mug cloths and we are kings and queens. And in the same sentence, people were like, yeah, I'll punch him in his neck. And I'm like, yo, you're not on a head wrap. Like, are you serious? So the word discipline, we'll say, well, I got to discipline my kids. And it's like, well, first of all, your definition is not the real definition, because when you look up the word discipline, it doesn't say beat anybody. When you look up the etymology of discipline, it comes from the Latin root disciplina. And disciplina is the same Latin root for disciple, right? But disciplina means to teach. And so if you're going to talk about disciplining children and you're talking about teaching them, well, if you're teaching, that has nothing to do with hitting. It's actually people are sitting and learning. Just think of the things you learned in life. The things you learned in life that you really applied did not come out of violence. I'm going to tell you that right now. It came out of your admiration for something, or got you thinking, or it helped you better in life. That's what teaching is about. And I can say that as a teacher myself, having been an educator, that you make an impact by how you help a person improve. And so the teaching that we do, the disciplining that we do, should help the children improve. But the hitting that we do and the yelling and the whatever else that we do, it doesn't make them improve. It actually makes them fearful. And people say, well, I got hit and it kept me off the streets and made me a better man. And I say, oh, okay, so what were you saying when it was happening, though? Oh, I wanted to kill her. Right, that's what I'm talking about. You were a child wanting to kill your mother. You rationalized it now and said it made you better and it kept you off the streets. But that fear, you don't want to create fear in your household. And for Black folks, given the world we live in, especially living in America, you talk about white supremacy and the types of things that they've done historically, if they're doing that on the outside, when our children come home it should be an environment of solace and comfort and pleasantries and nurturing. It should be those things. But if our children are coming home and they're experiencing fear, I'll scare them. I'm scared of my father. Who wants that in their home? That's not, you're not going to get your best citizen out of that type of household. So we need to handle that on a ton of levels.
You include a lot of passages from other folks that you talk to about that. I think you started at the very beginning when you first got the concept of writing this book, and just you presented the title, Beating Black Kids, and it mm-hmm. ended up being a 3-hour dialogue where people were talking about their own experiences mm-hmm. as a parent or as a child. And so you include a lot of these commentaries in the book, which I think is fantastic, just to hear some of these other perspectives. You have... Mm-hmm. One person, they shared just about this notion of sparing the rod, spoiling the child. And I wanted to read that and get you to comment. This is on page 26 of the book, where mm-hmm. this person, they shared, I became a born-again Christian in my early 20s and was still new to learning my new faith when my two daughters were young. At the time, I was working overnight at a New York law firm as a legal word processor and was very indoctrinated in biblical scripture. One night, I came into work and an attorney requested to have on hand a word processor and a proofreader outside his office. My supervisor selected me as the word processor and a coworker who was of the Rastafari faith as the proofreader. Rastafari also relies on biblical scripture, but usually for metaphoric purposes and not literal meanings. He told me that he had 7 children, and we got on the subject of forms of discipline. You see, based on my religion, I was not only encouraged by the church to utilize corporal punishment as a means of discipline, but sat in sermons that preached that if you spare the rod, your actions are ungodly and sinful because you are not raising your children correctly. Therefore, I promoted this outlook in the conversation I had with my coworker. He told me that he felt corporal punishment was not godly and that he never laid a hand on his 7 children. I then proceeded to say, "But the Bible says," and he politely stopped me to ask a question. "When you think of a rod, what do you think of?" I said, "Well, I think of a sturdy, dense stick." And he said, "Right, something that doesn't bend or break even when hitting something with it." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Now how do I look beating my child with something like that?" And I said, "Yeah, but," and he continued, "the Bible can be full of wisdom if taken in the right context." When I read rod in that scriptural text, I applied the same qualities of a rod to myself. I became the rod. I was sturdy, firm, and I did not break or bend. When I said no, my children didn't test or question it because they knew they couldn't bend Daddy. I never forgot that conversation because he passed so many jewels to me. I was moved by it. I did have a problem with consistency with my children, but realized that consistency is the key, or the rod that you must not spare. Great passage. Can you give some additional commentary, Ms. Kirkland?
Wow. And you know, so what I love, I'm just putting on Facebook that I love when the radio personality reads the book, because then we have a fuller interview. The questions are better because we can really get into the nitty gritty of it. So I'm loving listening to you reading the book. I'm like, oh, I need to read my book again. But I love that giving that example, because I'm giving it a lot. First of all, it's given to me a lot by the Christian community. They say, well, what about spirit rod for a child? You know, I believe in God. God, what God say? And I always go, God didn't say that. Who said that? Who said spirit rod for a child? And they go, well, yes, he did. I said, no, Who said that? And so they never, many times they don't have the answer. And I tell them, well, Solomon wrote that. And I tell them that Solomon, I don't know him or his mother, number one. I said, but two, that didn't come from Christ. And we're going to work to be Christ-like and not Solomon-like. How about that? And so that usually cancels that situation in this comment. And I add to it that the rod, what is it? What's the rod used? To most people, it's the staff that the shepherd carries. And I said, if it was that, he doesn't beat the sheep with that. He just keeps them in line, guides them, keeps them from straying away. He doesn't beat the sheep with that. So we need to, as a people, understand how the Bible was used to enslave us. That's just real basic. You can see that in the movie 12 Years a Slave. So when you look at certain passages like that to turn it into a meaning, oh, this means that I gotta, if I don't beat you, then this, I'm not spared a rod, spoil a child. I gotta beat you to get the right thing. But that, what? Slavery, hello. So I want our people to if you're going to apply everything in the Bible, I say, oh, if you want to do that, well, we need to go to Genesis. You should be a vegetarian too, because he tells us to be vegetarians in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. You go right in there. He says, I have given you every fruit-bearing tree that is to eat. This for you shall be for me. Blah, blah, blah. But my point is, you know, people like to take that to try to justify their behavior and say that it's biblical, but that has nothing to do with anything, and that doesn't make it stronger. If Christ didn't say it, I don't want to hear it. If you're in Christianity, I don't want to hear it. So, you know, we should not use our spirituality to back up why we hit our children. That doesn't make sense.
What about, I think I hear pretty regularly that, hey, if I don't beat my child, then Darren Wilson will. You know, we're in a system of white supremacy, the police, and, you know, white people, they have no regard for black people, black children either. So if I don't do it, then they'll go out into the world and think that they can behave any kind of way, and that will just, you know, give white people the ability to stomp all over them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very similar. The corollary would be, I call it the beloved syndrome. You know how Oprah killed her? She saw the master coming out, and Oprah went and killed her kids before the master could get there. That's sort of a psychosis that we have, that beating the child will protect them from outside harm. That is just heinously ridiculous, because what you're teaching when you hit them, they're not sitting there thinking any or learning anything good about that, or that's not making them a better citizen so that they do better in life. That's making them, that was started to make to, out of fear. Let me hit, if I hit you to get keep you in place, I'm trying to keep him from hanging you. So let me beat you. Let me beat you and make you fearful and cower so that when he comes in, you're just still. Like that is a very slave-like thought process. And the correlation to present is, if I don't beat you, the cops will beat you. Well, obviously, that beating them, because it still happens, that's not stopping nobody from killing them. But what we're creating offspring that don't trust the sources they should trust. You generally in life do not trust people who hit you or who bring you harm or who bring you pain. You generally don't confide in those people or feel safe around those people because you fear them just like you fear anybody else that brings you pain. I was speaking at Al Sharpton's National Action Network in New York, and one of the things I said in that presentation was, because it was during April, Child Abuse Prevention Month, but I said, you can't go out and protest police brutality and then come home and be brutal with your kids. It doesn't make sense. The reason why they are being attacked is because they're not being protected. Who can't see that we don't love our children to the highest degree? We talk to them abruptly. We yell at them. We call them names. We punch them in the throat. We pull their ears. We might hit them. We smack them. Those are not loving sentiments. But that's how we treat our offspring. No wonder they can't bring us the race up out of bondage or whatever, however we want to see the situation. We bring pain to our own offspring. Deep. So then they're going to go out in the world, and they're going to want to go out and create pain on somebody that they can create pain out on, whether they want to be bullies or gangbangers or whatever, because that's what they're taught. They're taught how not to negotiate, but how to use violence to get an end result. That's the lesson. Nothing else.
Wow. You mentioned how some of this direct connection to older forms of white supremacy, earlier forms of slavery, racism in this area of the world. Just can you talk about our relationship to trees and what they call discipline?
You mean, what do you mean in terms of being lynched?
Well, that and now you have in the book, you know, when you pick out some of the items that people choose to get beaten with, it's a switch. It's something you go grab off a tree and you just connected that to our whole relationship with trees in this area of the world.
Well, you know, and there's so many levels of even looking at this whole thing, but this notion of, I have a chapter in the book called Objects, and it's just a list of objects that people have told me that they've gotten beaten with. And so, of course, the switch is like one of the universal, it's like one of the top 10, what I call weapons of mass destruction, that people know. You go out, get your own switch. If you go out and get one that's too small, you better get a bigger one, and it's going to be worse because they see you trying to pick a small, you know, all this nonsense. And, come on, getting whipped with a tree, getting lynched in trees, I don't really have a significance that I give to trees per se in that light, but we can look at a lot of the similarities as to being whipped by white folks back in slavery and how we whip our own children. Like people say, oh, you're going to get a whooping. What? Why don't you see the connection between the word whipping and that? That's like a change of a vowel, because I've actually had people debate with me about this coming from slavery, like it didn't come from slavery. And I'm like, you're kidding me, right? You're going to get a whooping. You know, I'm going to give you a whooping. Like, it's all the same. It's the same derivative. Whipping with take off your belt. Take off your belt, that leather, whatever. How different is that than a whip? You know, it's just the same stuff. And I need us to see that and change it specifically and especially for the nationalist community, because we're the ones who talk the talk, but I need us to fully walk the walk. Don't come in here being upset with other people, and then you're not even bringing up your offspring in a way that's empowering. Man, when you beat a child, that's not empowering. You disempower them. You take away their power. You chip at their spirit. You make them less confident. And so we need to handle the things that we're doing to debilitate the generations to follow. It takes a little more work to communicate with young people and to use your mind to get them to behave. But you can do it. You can do it and refrain from the hitting. You want to, as human nature, sometimes you want to take a blow at somebody when they disagree with you or make you angry. But when it's your offspring, you have to give some thought to how you want, what kind of future you want. What kind of future do we want as a people? And when we look at the type of future we want, then we have to create that in our actions and create that when we communicate with them so that it actually manifests and it's not theoretical. In a lot of environments that I see that are African-centered, I see so much debilitating behavior that the young people, I can see why they would deviate from the mentality. Because the person who was toting unks and talking about power or whatever was the same person who brought them pain. Therefore, when I get older, I don't want to have nothing to do with none of that. Because that equals pain. All of that you're talking about, hair rats, unks, I got pain from somebody with talking that talk. So then they deviate from it when they get older. And so if we want our children to embrace these concepts and embrace their history and embrace these symbols and embrace this ideology, then we have to make it something that empowers them and gives them confidence and makes them happy. If they are happy as a result of this, then we'll see people who can carry on the torch of everything that our forefathers did prior to this point.
Can you talk about how just the science underlying a lot of this as well, because you bring that out as well, that beating young children, and I mean this happens when I say young, we're talking their children that are being beaten at 6, 5, 4 years old, extremely young. Beating a child that young impacts the development of their brain and their ability to make great decisions once they get older.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that point. You know, when I do workshops, a lot of times we take this for very, very lightly. This is how we were raised. A lot of my white colleagues come to me and they say, I try to talk to black people. They don't say it like that, but you know, I'm done though. They say, I try to talk to my students, and they say, I can't say anything because I'm not black, and this is how we raise our kids. So first off, I make it real clear. We're not going to get this twisted now, because black people didn't start this, all right? And then I got to show them how their great-great-grandfather contributed to this picture. We're not going to play the blame game of I want black people, right? So that's one thing. But the other thing that I do when I talk to these groups of parents and of educators that work with our children is how it's affecting brain development. So you have a part of the brain that's called the regulatory part of the brain. And the regulatory part of the brain helps you regulate, basically make decisions in times of adversity. So good, regulate. You know, you make these decisions and you know how to chart, you know, fight or flight helps you make good decisions, right? Okay. Well, if a child experiences toxic stress is when a child experiences stress that's no, there's no nurturing. Like if a child falls and hits their knee and the mama goes, oh, baby, come here for a minute, let me help you. Even though they're experiencing some stress and the pain of hitting their knee, the nurturing that comes after it makes it not, it lessens the stress. But if the child is experiencing toxic stress where there's yelling, there's beating, there's slapping, there's all of that, and then there's nothing as a result, go in your room, get your A out of here and all of that. Well, when a child experiences toxic stress before they're 4 years old, the regulatory part of the brain does not develop. And so what you're looking at in our community, you're looking at a whole bunch of folks with no regulatory equipment. And when you look at that, it's like, oh, that's the part of the brain that makes decisions in times of adversity. Is that why the community looks so jacked up? Because people literally don't have the faculties to make it better. Regulatory brain, gone, matter, dark matter in the brain. You know, it's just not developed like a person who has been treated well and who hasn't had toxic stress in them. So when I talk to these parents and they find that out about the brain development and how they've impacted the child's brain development, I actually get a lot of moms who go, they get quiet, and then they go, so what can we do differently? And they want to implement a change. See, us beating our kids, nobody wants to do it. Nobody really wants to do it. It doesn't feel good when we do it. But a lot of us just don't know what else to do when we do it. So that's why I wrote the book, so that people can know what to do and how to think and how to start to debunk some of the stuff that the conditioning that we've been given over the years.
BeatingBlackKids.com. The book, the website, outstanding material, Ms. Asada Kirkland. My question is going to be, just to make sure that folks get this clear, you are zero tolerance on any form of hitting, but I just want to make sure I read this passage really quick before I ask a question. This is on page 21, the chapter marks, both physical and the enduring psychological, emotional marks that go with whipping, spanking, whatever term you want to use, this physical violence. And this is, again, this is where you quoted a different person who's giving their commentary on growing up and being whipped. And they write, to be a child is to kill, to beat a child is to kill a soul. As a child, I was outspoken, inquisitive, and active, and enjoyed making people laugh. Sure, that sometimes included talking back to adults or disrupting the class, but I never meant to hurt anyone. Never. As you can imagine, this caused a lot of conflict for me, always being sent to the principal's office or home from the after-school program or kicked out of activities because nobody had the patience to deal with me. Naturally, at home, I questioned things I was told and would act out against things I did not agree with. As a result, my family beat me until the age of 13. I say my family because in my family, the children were raised by the whole village. Everyone got a piece of me, but to no avail. My family members tried their hardest to change who I was. The physical pain they caused me did not outlast the emotional and spiritual setbacks that resulted. As a little person, and then even as a teenager, we looked to adults for guidance and direction, comfort and support, and most importantly, love and acceptance. To physically cause a child pain is not a sign of love. It is what it is. pain. It's more than just a beating, it's invalidation. It's forcing another being to succumb to your command, and it's making another person wrong without verification. Its effects are numerous and often overlooked. Its physical effects are short-lived, but the mental detriment is long-lasting. While adults see a beating as a punishment for a misdeed, a beating for a child is change. It's more than just a reaction to action. It's outright disgust and disapproval. The interpretation of a beating for a child is not, "Oh, but they love me, so it's okay." It's more like, "Why don't they like me, and what did I do wrong?" It's more than a belt to the bottom and blisters to the arms or bruises to the legs. It's the thoughts of why the beating is happening in the first place that stay with the child, because nobody ever explained to him or her that there was another way to express oneself, another way to fix the problem, another way to make people feel good, another way to be heard. Although the bruises to the body heal, one cannot take back bruises to the soul. Did I get it correctly? Mm. You are zero tolerance across the board for any form of hitting, violence to children?
You got it. Zero tolerance. Not one iota. Not sometimes you have to. None of that. Not 1 minute. Nope. Can't hit them. Don't hit them. And I tell people, if you do hit them, then you need to be ready for what that creates in the future. Just be ready to handle that.
Wow. And your thought, what exactly does that tend to create in the future?
It manifests into a lot of different things. And in the book, you see stories of people who are various ages. Like the story you just read, she's a woman now, but she actually was one of my students back in the day. Used to be a teacher when she was like 13 and 12. And now she's probably in her early 30s. But she, there are people in that book that are like in their 60s, and they still, my godmother, she had a story in there, I think in the chapter called Unplay the Messages. And she talks about the things that her mother used to say to her and the names she used to call her, and how that prevented her from doing things in life later, like whether it was driving, or she just didn't feel smart enough to handle certain things, but that's because of the way she was brought up. So, you know, you do this to our children, it can manifest in ways where they go inward and don't live to their full potential. I have a brother who, brother had to be about 6'6". Big brother, I don't know how much he weighed, but he talked about his fear of speaking, because when he grew up, he was not only beat as a child, and people try to say, oh, beating is different than spanking. Mm-mm. No, it's just different gradients of pain. Every time the body experiences pain, cells die away. You can look at it from punching somebody and then bruising. You see a bruise, that's dying cells. Or you can look at menstruation. It's all cells dying. Anytime there's pain, cells are dying. So when we bring pain to our kids, cells are actually dying away. It's like you're killing them softly, right? So this brother was extremely big, and he had a fear of speaking in front of others, because he said the way he was raised, you didn't talk. I better not say anything. And it made a man, he's a big black man, 6-something. He should be a force to be reckoned with, you know, coming in the world and, you know, really taking charge and protecting. This brother don't even feel that, because he wasn't raised in that. We usually raise our children to take authority, but we definitely do not raise them to be authorities. And so we need to handle that. That's what it creates. Kids who don't have, children just don't have the abilities that they can have if they were given power instead of punches. Can you hear me?
I hit my mute button. Yes, ma'am. I think another one of the phrases that you say regularly is, as opposed to raising your hand, raise your skills. And we talk on this program, if we're going to replace something, so if we're really serious about having healthy parenting techniques, and you're pretty unequivocal, violence, whatever we're calling it, spanking, whipping, whatever, that is not healthy. Mm-hmm. That's something that we should retire like immediately, as soon as possible. Replacing that mm-hmm. with what? What would be some better strategies that parents can employ?
Well, if you and I have a disagreement, and we're sitting together and we're disagreeing about an issue, I am not going to stand up and just punch you in your face. I'm just not going to do that. Can you imagine that? Like, I disagree with you and then I pick up something and hit you with it. Or can you imagine me saying to you, I want you to do something. Can you imagine me saying to you, didn't you hear me tell you to get up? I asked you to get the you got, like, that's so debasing to be talked to like that. So we would never talk to each other like adults, as adults like that, because we understand that it would be offensive and you would automatically lose respect for me, like, right off the cuff because I didn't know how to carry myself. So why do we not see that when we're talking to young people? I think if we communicate with young people versus talking at them and vomiting our commands at them, then we would have a different reality. So all we have to do is communicate with them. I don't want to say talk. Some people say, well, I do talk. I talk. That's all I do is talk. Yeah, and you sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. That's what you sound like. Well, nobody want to hear you. You know, especially in this day and age, they have so much stimuli. They have iPhones, iPads, iWatches, Mac Air, like it's TV. They have so much stimuli. It's not like when we were growing up. Don't bring no young person to your stories about what happened when you were growing up. When you were growing up, it might not have even been no TV. I know when I was growing up, there wasn't no cell phones. You know, so there's this, my daughter said to me one day, what's a typewriter? You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't expect them to vibrate, resonate, or move at the pace that we moved at. So what it means is that we have to pick up the pace to match the offspring that we have today. And so that's really it. You know, the solution is to understand who we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with young people from our day. That was yesterday. That's not today. Today is a different day. When I say the word coding to a young person, I said to my daughter, what do you know about coding? My daughter actually had an answer. The average adult will not have an answer because they don't even know what that is. Coding is simply the language you need to know when you're operating computers or you're operating video games or you're operating Facebook. Like, a person who develops those things knows coding. But my people don't even know that word. Like, I was watching something from, I think it's code.org, and they were talking about how for this generation, there will be millions of jobs available because it's such a new industry. But they said, but there will not be enough people with skills to fill them. Deep. See, that's where I'm on. I'm on that. I'm on, let's build a nation of people who know the languages necessary to go into the 22nd century, you know. And so it's that. That's how you get to kids today. That's how you be interesting. You have to come where they are, and you have to know the language that they speak and have an understanding of their world, and then you'll be interesting enough to listen to. We come with our old boring adult nonsense that we would give them. We know more technology than our parents. And so the same, every generation has a problem with the younger generations, whatever, and we just need to find ways to be on the same page with them and then have a dialogue with them. Many black folks have a viewpoint. I'm not negotiating with no child. Then your child won't have negotiation skills. It's just that simple. So when they go for a job, they won't be able to negotiate a thing. They'll take that minimum wage. As opposed to our children who know how to negotiate, they can say, well, what field are you looking for? Well, I've thought about, you know, starting off at $70,000. I'll start off at $70,000 as a base, but nothing lower than that. What? They don't have that skill, nor do they have the courage to come at it like that. But that's because of the way they're raised. They're not raised to do that. We're raised to be on slave mode and to be fearful and to be submissive and to only speak when you're spoken to and to, you know, all of these things that prevent us from being powerful. That's what we instill in our children.
Context of white supremacy. I want to read one more passage from the book that's kind of pushing in the vein of, if we're replacing the violence to children as a form of quote-unquote discipline and having more communication and being cautious with the words that we use with our children, how we talk to them, what we say, what we don't say, the chapter, What's in a Word. You write this on page 51. Being aware of what we say to or around children can help shape who they become and how they act. What we say can chip away at their joy or pull them down. We need to think about how what we say is going to affect a child's day, week, or life. I have heard adults in my workshops talk about things said to them as children that affect their behavior to this day. Sometimes they never speak up for themselves. Sometimes they can't believe they can successfully do something. The fact is, words can hurt. What hurts is not the word itself, is the tone and the intention behind the words. When parents are critical of their children and say things without thinking about how they affect their children, they can damage their children's self-esteem. Some parents may not care and feel they have a right to say what they want because they are the adults, but they need to look at the type of adults they are going to put in the world. Will the adults we create be so used to being told stop that they can't go and accomplish things? Will our children be so used to commands and being told what to do that they will be adults that only take orders? Or will our children be so used to conversations and have the ability to think and choose for themselves that they will actually come into the world with enough skills to make good choices? Power can come to people at an early age. If freedom to think and choose is given early on, then thinking and choosing become regular behaviors. Practicing patterns of abusive behavior can only make the givers and receivers of that abuse feel low. We may have to change "don't cross the street when a car is coming" to "look both ways when cars are coming." We can turn "be quiet" into "listen to the volume of your voice." I have even heard, "how about using your inside voice?" That's pretty good too. Instead of telling them our opinion of what they cannot do or will not become, we can listen to them, watch what they are doing, and help them grow. Let's just teach them, man. One of the keys is to teach in the positive. It is all in our language. That is what the words above are about. If we are aware of the impact we have on our children and how much they actually take in from us, we can teach lessons through consciously talking in the positive and make a major difference in how they behave. We can affect the way they act within the world dramatically. It will freak you out most when you hear them repeat what you have said in their own everyday language. Teach them to ask questions if they do not understand something. This has made me smarter because I have to come up with good answers to the questions I am asked. I will stop there. Any additional commentary you'd like to add?
I'm just loving listening to it. I'm like, wow, this is some sound advice. I think I need to go back to my book and pull some things out for people. I really don't have much more to say. I mean, that's really said in a very succinct way that I want our people to take the time to conjure up better ways to make our children happy and conjure up ways to create harmony in our households so that the confusion can end and we can really start to build them up into people who can save us.
I want to make sure we get in some questions. If folks, particularly if we have parents that are listening in, feel free to give us a ring. The number is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I guess one more quick question I'll get in before we get to some of the callers. I think it's also very important. You talk about how sometimes, particularly when we're out in public, that some of the beatings and some of the rougher behavior we exhibit as parents sometimes comes because we're embarrassed. Nobody likes to be out in public and feel like, you know, everybody is watching their child have, you know, a tough moment where they're not really behaving well. And, you know, this is embarrassing us, making me look like, you know, I'm a poor mother or I'm a poor father. And, you know, I'm either going to go to town right now, engaging in some violence, or I'm going to start shouting or telling you, wait till we get home. And, you know, you're going to get it. Just can you touch on that briefly?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a chapter about that. But my thing is, it's not about anybody outside of you and your child. You know, your child chose the children. I have a chapter called You Got Chosen. And the child chooses the parent that they want to come through. And if we are engaged with our children, then 9 times out of 10, they're not going to be acting out in the street because you're so engaged with them. You're having a conversation with them. You're listening when they want to stop and pick up a toy in a store or they want to point out a cereal. You're not so preoccupied in your world that you forget about their world and realize that the things that we like, they don't like. Nobody want to walk around no boring store shopping for food or clothes or the things that you know you have to do as a parent may not be interesting for the child. So then what can you do to make it an adventure? You know, I go to Trader Joe's and they have the little carts for the little kids while you have your big cart. Yeah, now y'all could be engaged. Get him to hold something, put it in the cart. But we don't take the time to really put them, to make them a part of what we're creating. And so we're just mad when they're mad and they got to be involved in what we're doing. You know, and it's like, nah, you have to give some consideration to the entire scene that's taking place and operate like a real family that communicates together. But again, we weren't really brought up like that. We were brought up to stay at the child's day in the child's place, and that's all you do, and nobody don't want to hear or care what you have to say or think. You just do what I say and not what I do, and that's a problem.
The address, beatingblackkids.com. You'll see YouTube content. You can get the book. Great information. You'll see some of her archived interviews as well. Same title as the book, Beating Black Kids. Great information. Nab, some of the folks who dialed in with questions. I think this is Thomas in New York, a black parent. Did you have any questions for Ms. Kirkland? You should be with us.
Good evening, Doc. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Ms. Kirkland.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I have some questions for you, but, you know, I hear him listening to you talk. And I hear what Gus is reading from your book. And you talked earlier about black nationalists and black nationalist community or whatever. And what you're talking sounds a lot more like Scientology than black nationalism. Don't hit your kids. Don't discipline your kids by the other definition, not the one you clarified. Let them be free and develop. Let them live, be happy and merry. I mean, that's just very much in the doctrine of the Scientologist as opposed to traditional black nationalism. My question for you is, do you think that the black race was better as a people, more together as a people, back in the day when we had that the village raises a kid and, you know, you knew if you acted up and you were around the corner, the neighbor was able to give you a nice whipping so you didn't go around there and act up? Or today, when we have the kids today, pretty much just acting a fool. Which one do you think was a better black people? The ones who were being whipped by their parents in the community, or the ones who aren't?
Well, first, I want to say, because I know in the beginning you said something about it sounds like Scientology versus black nationalism, and it really is not either. We're talking about just common sense. Black folks usually don't, a child being happy and merry, you usually don't hear our children match with no happy and merry. And I think that's what I'm talking about, that is a problem, because we put off happy and merry and whatever as another race. That's their kids. Their kids is happy and merry. But it's like, what's wrong with our children being happy? Like, I never hear us talking about making our kids happy. We almost get mad if they are happy, you know, so there's that. That has nothing to do with Scientology. And I'm not, that would be a whole other conversation if I asked if you've ever done it before based on how you said it, like you compared it, but that's okay. It's all good. I'm just here to say that it's not either. It's just that we do not think that way as a people, and we need to as a people, just as being civil. So the second thing, back in the day, it takes a village. Now, if a village is raising a child, here's that definition again, how we're defining this. A village raising a child has nothing to do, should not have anything to do with the village being able to beat a child. She could beat you, I could beat you, we all got children to beat you. No, it shouldn't have nothing to do with that. A village raising a child means that you have extra supervision. So that if the parent is not there, then another parent or adult can be there to supervise and make sure that the child stays safe. That is what the village should be doing. Have you ever seen the movie Quilombo? Quilombo. You ever seen that movie?
No.
Okay. So Quilombo is about the African slave revolts in Brazil. And when you watch that movie and you watch how our people revere the children and you watch how they let the children be free, you can see a village raising children in that movie. And that's really what it is. So when you compare the children of today who apparently, quote unquote, run amok and do whatever versus when the people in the community could beat you and your mother could beat you, that wasn't better. And today is not better. None of the conditions are ideal. Because in the past, when you talk about the community being able to beat you and somebody else beat you, you don't even feel safe in your environment. You in your own environment feeling like you could get hit by anybody at any given time. That's not good. You want children that feel like they're watched and protected and that they're walking down the street and they're not going to act up because they know Miss So-and-so is just as responsible for you as your mom. But they shouldn't be fearful of her or the mom. It just should be that we're making them safe. Hey, Johnny, make sure you get home at so-and-so time. Yes, Miss So-and-so. You know, just communicate and get our children safe. That should be the advance. That should be the mission and the message. Today's children, if they're any way that they are, it is because of our negligence to help them be what they should be. Simple as that. They're going to mimic what they see. And so the correction will only come from how we communicate. I don't know many people who ask the brothers on the corner, hey, what's up? How was your day? Or hear a brother cursing on the back of the bus and will go and walk to him and say something. We'll sit right there and let them curse and they won't say anything. And they're actually doing it to get attention. Because I know when I get up and I go walk over to them and say something, they actually stop. But that's because the intention is to love them.
Can I rephrase my question so that you can answer the question, please? My rephrase is, say, back in the day when kids were being beat and anyone had the chance to beat a kid because they were out of line if they saw them out of line. It's not like that today. Do you think that back in that day, black people were better off and acted better than they do today?
I almost don't have the answer to that because you can answer it. Look at our people back then. Were we better off back then? The answer is no. Look at it. Look at the community. We might have had a clean community and somebody might have been able to, people had the permission to beat your
that
child.
The community back then was better than it is today. You're saying the way we acted amongst each other, we weren't shooting each other. We weren't riding around slashing each other on trains. We were pretty much civil to each other. We understood that our enemy was white people. That era. Those people, Martin Luther King, they lived in
that era. I can agree with you.
They went around the corner and they were seen doing something. The neighbor had the right to pull up the switch and beat them. I'm asking you, in that era, do you think black people were better as a people than they are today, where we have no discipline at all in our community amongst few sections of it?
So I'm going to answer again, and I'm going to say we were better in that day in those ways, but it had nothing to do with being able to beat our offspring. Believe that. The reason that we were better as citizens in that day is because we didn't have so much stimuli from the outside world to make us everything we are now. Like my mama just got TV. My mother's 66 years old. She just got TV when they were little. So when you talk about outside influences in the community, there was a whole different cultural moray at that time and morals at that time that existed in society. You sat down at a dinner table and you communicated. Those are the things that added to a quality society. But when you got a society now that's a TV dinner, that's a microwave, nobody's sitting at the dinner table at home, TV is on, parents walking down the street with their face in the palm pilot and not looking at the children running up. Like, that's a reflection of outside the what's happening in society and how individuals behave in society now. It has nothing to do with we beat our children more than, and so we had a better society. Beating our children didn't make the society better. We could actually be stronger if people were given power than punches. It would have been different because kids would be trained in a way that helped them to review the community, understand what was going on, make decisions about protection of the family. Like, they would come home and be listening and getting power from the older generation versus trying to run away from the older generation and be different. If we just, as a older generation, feed them the things that they need to be better. And so, yes, it was better than today, but no, it was not better because we beat our offspring. No way.
Okay. You mentioned Brazil earlier, and you said, you named the movie. What was the name of that again?
It's called Quilombo. Quilombo.
I posted it on the Facebook page. Brazil.
And you said mm-hmm. in Brazil, the slaves had the ability to protect their own children?
No, I said, when you watch that movie, what you're going to see is how the children were revered in the community. You see how the village dealt with the children. And you watch those children run. It's to the point to where when the Portuguese came into the community to try and capture the children had the type of freedom and fun. They were not running. Them children in that film were laughing, jumping up in the tree, jumping down out the tree onto the Portuguese. Like, it's a whole different flavor. Like, the children were happy and handling the Portuguese with capoeira. Like, you know, so it's a different flow. Like, when you, and you saw the children sitting at the feet of the elders, listening to the elders tell the stories. Like, it's a whole different picture of village raising children, was my point. So when you see that movie, Quilombo, it just gives you a slice of what I'm talking about when we talk about a village raising children. That's why I brought it up.
Okay, and my last question for you, first, did you know that L. Ron Hubbard was a racist?
Well, it depends on, I don't know where you get that data, but what I'm looking at right now on my shelf is something he wrote called Message for Black People. And so Message for Black People, which he wrote, says, the first line of it says, aside from what it means to whites, uses technology to help your people. What? Like, he made it was real clear. He didn't write message to white people. He didn't write message to Chinese people.
He
didn't write none of that.
To black people. He wrote message to black people because he was paid by the South African government to come up with a religion that they can use to take the black people's land and let them just, you know, go over because there was a lot of rebelling against them. So I would just ask, just on the humbug, just type in L. Ron Hubbard in Africa and see his interactions there and how that religion was formed and who it was formed for and what it was formed for. And I'll be my line. Thank you, Gus.
Right on. Person.
I just need to respond to that real quick because I don't want misconceptions. I've been a Scientologist for 14 years. And in my 14 years of studying this technology, it has done nothing but built me and helped me to build my people. Like, it's helped me to help black people strengthen their companies. It's helped me to help black people get out of some real basic challenges with finances, a ton of different things. And so I'm not too sure where you get your data, which is fine. You can get your data wherever you desire. But what I know about what this does and this technology does is one of the main reasons why the whole Nation of Islam is studying it right now. Farrakhan got the whole Nation of Islam studying it. Anytime I run into a brother and sister from the Nation of Islam, they could run down the whole gym with me, everything. So it's okay. People can get the data where they want to get it. But people say, well, when I go online, I get this, that type of information. I said, well, check this out. I'm not going to go to the Ku Klux Klan to find out about black people. So I just tell people they want to know about Scientology, just go to the Scientology.org to see what it's about. Yeah, got a lot of white people in it. Yeah, it's their thing. But I'm going to tell you something. You learn that technology, you learn something that will take you out of a lot of our unethical behaviors. So from what my experience has been in my studies, I don't see a racist component of what L. Ron Hubbard is and what Scientology is. But that's because I operate on truth and I take the data and I use it. Simple as that.
Right on. Before we get our next call, I did want to submit, I think some of the older black people, when I say older, I mean black people that are over 70. I think everybody here speaking on the conversation right now is way below 70. So black people that are older, over than 70, I think some of them, not all, but at least some of the folks I've talked to, Mr. Fuller, I can think of off the top of my head, and some of the people that are quoted in Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, I think they would submit from firsthand account that a lot of the misbehaviors that are going on, black people fighting and that sort of thing, a lot of that stuff was going on then. If we want to talk 50, 60, 70 years ago, that a lot of that stuff was going on then, that this is not anything that is new behavior. It might be intensified because of some of the chemicals that have been dumped on black people over the last 50 years or so, that has greatly exacerbated a lot of our problems, as well as access to weaponry that was not there. If we want to talk 100 years ago, that those are certainly two things that have contributed mightily to the way things look now. But in terms of just us not treating black people well, that there was a lot of that going on, even, as I said, if you want to rewind 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and some of the people that are still around that can attest to that, I think some, not all, but I think some of them would be, unfortunately, they would be able to document and give you firsthand experience. The person that dialed in, I think this is our retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Ms. Asada Kirkland?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone. I am not 70, but I was born in the 1950s and grew up in the 1960s, and I can testify that I never experienced anybody putting their hands on somebody else's child and then taking them to that child's house and then having that child getting beaten. I've never experienced or heard anything like that. I hear a lot of non-white black people talking about that used to happen. And I grew up in an area where there was nobody but non-white black people. I agree with what was just said, Gus, as far as how we go about the means of the things that are happening today. It was going on back during that time. The only reason why it may not have been as frequent is because of the weaponry that we have access to that was not available during those periods of time. And also, I heard Mr. Fuller say just a few weeks ago by listening to some archives, is that when you sit on the back of that bus, where legally, if you don't be on the back of that bus, you can get killed, then you don't have a whole lot to be puffed up about with another black person. Everybody, all of the black males are black back there in the back of that bus, or black people in the back of that bus, and they more or less are kind of like moping over the idea that scratching the head, well, we don't know what we're going to do about this, so we're not. So that's what kind of like a lot of cases that keeps us from not doing the things, the negative things, now again that we do now. But anyway, my question to the guests is this: can you express to us how slavery was one of the during that period of time and mistreatment that our slave masters did to us? You know, we were like beasts of burden at the time, and we still are to a large extent, but how that relates to how we punish our children today. Could you just give some expressions to that period of time and how it is still carried within us, to whereas we actually deal with one, and how that relates to how we deal with one another as far as beating our children? Thank you, ma'am.
Sure, brother. Thank you. And of course, I've been in debates with black folks who try to deny that point and whatever. Like I said a little earlier, it is very clear that this behavior is a derivative from being slaves. People say, well, other races, they beat their kids and whatever they're talking about. I tell them I'm not an expert on that, but I'm an expert on black folks that and how we hit our children and where it comes from. You could just tell from the types of things we say. Like you said earlier, well, if I don't spank them, the policeman going to get them. The world, and back in the day, they said, well, if I don't spank them, the mass is going to get them. Like, you don't see how that's a derivative of slavery? Like, you're creating pain. You know that the one thing that's going to keep them quiet is pain, bringing them pain. So you bring them pain so that the master won't bring them more pain or kill them. Like, that's just that's a psychotic reality. And the behavior, the word whipping, the hitting with a leather strap, even hitting with the paddle in schools, like, all of these things come from slave experiences, using the Bible to justify being a slave master over slaves. I mean, if you don't know about the Willie Lynch letter, go get that and find that, read that. You know, but there's just a lot of ways that you can just look at us. Let me tell you something. It really also has just created a contempt for our children that really is a problem. I very seldom see mothers and fathers showing affection and endearment to their black children. I have a book up my sleeve that I haven't written yet that has to do with, when you live in New York on the Upper East Side primarily, it's like an affluent white community, and you see a lot of nannies, which are black, usually Caribbean mothers. And they go and they're watching the white children, and fine, I don't have a problem with that, right? That's a job. But what I have a problem with is I see them talking to those children. I see them rubbing their hair. I see them embracing them. I see them talking to them, 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds, talking to them. And I see them treating them civilly. But when I talk to those same women about their children, boy, do they have stories about how they whip their children's tail and how they hurt their children and how they hit them. They don't say the word hurt, but they talk about how they hit their children and don't want to hear them, pop them in the mouth and hit them and give them a whacking. My problem is that you are treating this child civilly and you're treating your own children like animals. And so we have an issue with how we handle our children and how we feel about our children that comes from a place that I think is deep and dark, and we don't really look at it, but you can trace it on back. When you look at how we have had to look at our children and deal with them, you could trace it back. I don't know if you know the term gator bait, but gator bait, they primarily used in Florida and maybe in like the Louisiana area. Gator bait came from, they used to feed black babies to alligators to lure them out of the swamps. And so they would come, take the black babies, put them in cages, and watch the alligators chomp on the babies, and they would get the alligators out and sell the alligator skins for whatever. You could go online and look at this. If you research it and all of that, you can even see figurines of little black babies with alligators. Now, my thing with bringing that up is that you get to a point where you almost either are going to go crazy, or you got to desensitize yourself or detach yourself from feeling affection for little black kids, because they get taken from you. Don't get attached to them. They get fed to animals. And so you see cartoons with black kids and barns and in places with animals, and I think there is a desensitizing that we have developed for our children to make it so that we bring them harm. They can be hurt. They can be talked to anyway. Like, we don't have a reverence for them, and we don't get pleasure from them. I hear people talk about how they get on my last nerves, and there's just this generational discontent I feel we have for our children that we need to handle. And I believe it comes from some of that experience of having to detach ourselves from loving them, because they get taken away from us, or they get shown to us as something less than or animal-like. So yeah, it gets deep, and I take it. We have to go there and look at that so that we can start to heal and do better.
Yeah, I shudder at the experience of hearing cousins of mine, male and shockingly females, being stripped butt naked, and the female child is being beaten about her breast, about her backside, her reproductive areas. I don't see no way that's going to make anybody improve. You know, I'm sorry. I used to get it myself, but I'm talking about a person who
was doing the very best that they could, and where how I equated, and but it was certainly mixed with a lot of other things that were very positive. But the beatings, yeah. they didn't do anything to assist me into being successful. Thank you, ma'am.
Exactly. Thank you. I appreciate you. I mean, that's all I want us to see. It's not to, even my book, it's not accusatory. It doesn't condemn. It just says, let's make a change. Because this behavior, yes, a lot of people say stuff like, you know, my mom did the best she could with what she had, and we got that. But if they did the best they could, and it still brought us pain and didn't make us powerful, then that means we can do better, especially if we can identify it. You know, if we say, well, I turned out all right, turning out fine is not good. Turning out fine is average. Turning out fine is mediocre. I actually created an acronym for turning out fine, F-I-N-E, and that's failing indefinitely, never emerging. Turning out fine is not permissible. We need to turn out excellent. I never hear a person say, I got beaten, I turned out excellent. I got beaten, I turned out phenomenal. They never say that. They say, I got beaten, I turned out fine. So we have to start creating generations of black children who turn out better than fine and turn out phenomenally, because we actually put that in them and kept them happy and productive at all times and never fearful of anything.
I was reminded, you just answering our caller in Florida's questions, our previous guest, Eric Grimes, in his book, Why Our Children Hate Us, How Black Adults Betray Black Children. He touches on a lot of the similar themes. Also, Dr. Joy DeGruy, I think the third time she was a guest on the program, she wrote Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. The third time she was a guest on the program, she said that she talks to, obviously, a lot of black parents, and she said that it's the same type of thing, a carryover from earlier periods of white supremacy, the devaluing of black children, where they'll be talking about children in school and she'll hear black parents talking about their children, just like, oh, his behavior is terrible and blah, blah, blah. And then you investigate and the child is like on honor roll and doing all these great things, but they're still talking like the child is just not valued. The child is not being talked about as something that is great and outstanding and that sort of thing. And she was linking that to racism and how that has just impacted the way that we talk about and just don't value black children. And then the gator bait, the Ragsdales, they were on the program, Gwen and J. Justin Ragsdale. They do the Black Slave Museum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they have a lot of exhibits about black children being used as gator bait. They talked about that when we had Gwen Ragsdale on the program right at the end of 2015. The person that called in, our caller in Michigan, did you have a question for Miss Asada Kirkland? You should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers and to your guests. This is an interesting discussion. I did have a few questions. What is your definition of discipline, and what is your definition, or what do you mean when you say discipline and beating?
Sure. A little earlier we talked about discipline, and I was talking about if you actually look up the definition of discipline, and it's particularly the etymology of discipline, the root where it comes from. Discipline comes from the Latin root disciplina, and disciplina means to teach. And so when you talk about the word discipline, it's the same exact derivative of the word disciple. You know, Jesus had disciples, and that comes from to teach. He taught the disciples. So disciplining has to do with teaching. My daughter is 12, and we're vegetarians, and she's going through this phase now where she just is loving all kind of starchy foods. You know, rice is all right, but French fries and this and that, and, you know, she's not eating the meat, but when I want her to sit down and eat this vegetable and eat that vegetable, she only likes certain ones, and she doesn't want to eat everything. Okay, cool. So when I make a full dinner, and she doesn't want to eat, and she's walking out the kitchen like, I'm not going to eat. So I block her from leaving the kitchen, and I say, wait a minute now. I said, let's talk about this. I said, now let's talk about what does starch do? What does starch do when you eat it? And she goes, it turns to sugar. Exactly. Okay, cool. Now, when it turns to sugar, what can that mean? If too much sugar is in your system, you can become diabetic. Okay, got you. I said, do you know it's 12-year-olds and children that have to shoot insulin? I was like, I do not want that for you. I said, now let me just ask you a question. Based on how you're eating right now, I said, would you say that your eating is survival, or is your eating pushing on the road to die? And you know what she said? She said, it's pushing me on the road to die. And I said, that's all I got to say. And I walked out. You know that girl? She was eating seaweed. Girl, I came out the kitchen. She was eating seaweed. She was eating two types of seaweed. She was drinking a bottle of water. Like, I don't have to yell. We're just going to talk this through real quick. And so when you talk about discipline, instead of saying, sit down, you better eat those vegetables, you better get that in, that doesn't get the person to want to do it. I couldn't do that to an adult and say, you better eat this, you better, they're going to do what they want to do. But if we sit down and I give you some reasoning and I help you think through it, then you're going to make an educated decision about what you want to do. And so the disciplining has to do with that, helping them understand or overstand what they're doing and how it impacts them and the people around them. And I explained to her even, if you continue on the road that you're going with this eating, if you have to go to the emergency room, I said, see, then I have to take you. So that's, I'm wrapped up in this world of why is she eating this way? And I said, so as long as you're living with me, these are the things you're going to have to do. Or else let's just find you somewhere else to live. That's how that is, easy as pie. They're not going to have these same type of guidelines. So it's conversation, it's talking, and so discipline involves teaching as opposed to striking.
And what suggestions do you give to parents who may not necessarily have that type of rapport with their children? Or let's say that same scenario, they don't have the rapport where the child will listen to them. There's just not that type of, give and take and conversation. What type of suggestions would you give to parents in a different situation?
My thing is that that type of rapport has to be developed, period. It's one of those things, may not be the easiest thing, but what it's going to take on the parent's behalf is to open up a little bit. Like I did a workshop once and I told a parent that she had a situation where, she had a preteen who wasn't listening or whatever. And so when I showed her what she was going to have to do, and I went to her and I put my hands on her cheeks and I put my face close to her face and I said, you're going to have to go to your little girl and hold her face like this and say to her, look, I really love you. And I'm afraid sometimes. And when I talked about that close interaction and that holding her face, she told me straight up, she said, I can't do that. She said, I can't do that. I was like, what? Like, she really saw a problem with doing that. Now, some of that comes from when you have adults that have never experienced that type of proximity or closeness from adults in their life, then they definitely can't even see how to do that in their own life. Not always the case, but a lot from what I've seen. But it's going to take the type of communication with the young person to find out how they're really feeling and to let them know where you're coming from. Sometimes adults are just running with their lives, and let's say they have a preteen or even an 8-year-old for that matter, and the 8-year-old's acting up. Let's say the mom just got a new boyfriend and the child's acting up or whatever. Maybe the child don't like that boyfriend. Maybe they don't like, but I've seen a lot of parents, that's not even an issue. They just want that child to get comfortable with the new person regardless of what they're talking about, because they come, I need love too. I need somebody in my life. See, for me, the priority is the child. And so that means a conversation with the child about, let me ask you, is there anything that is making you upset right now, or what is it? Because I want to let you know how I feel. But if it's a conversation, usually adults don't converse with children. They just talk at them and don't really get, that's why the children don't open up. They say, is anything wrong? And children 9 times out of 10 say, no, nothing, because they're a little afraid to say what they really feel. But we have to create environments where they don't feel afraid to say what they feel, even if we don't want to hear what they have to say, and that's usually the case. We don't want to hear the truth, but we need to create environments enough where the children know, you can say it. I am not going to hit you. You can say it. I am not going to yell at you. I just want to know, blah, so I can help and fix the situation, just like you would with an adult. You know, if you want to create some type of harmony with an adult, you would explain and break it down and have them listen in. The same thing with a young person. But you're going to have to regain, or an adult has to get their trust. And to get a person's trust, you know you have to disclose a little and they disclose a little. It's like a negotiation and a give and take, and you develop that rapport. And they'll have respect for you, and you start to see a change when they see you open up a little bit as an adult.
Okay, great. I have a couple more questions. Are you a are you married, or do you are you a single parent? Or
no, I'm a single mom. I am a single mom.
Okay. My next question is: do you think we are able to properly discipline our children in a system of racism, white supremacy, where Black people, in my opinion, aren't able to truly be parents? But I'm just wondering, do you think that non-white people are able to truly discipline their children in the system, in this system?
Oh, definitely. Because, see, for me, my rearing of my daughter, and even when I was a teacher in the high school systems of Chicago, and these were alternative high schools, so these were high schools where kids would drop out and they came back to get their diplomas. But and I bring them up because I do take responsibility for helping to parent them, and that's coming from their parents. But definitely we can discipline them because, see, again, we got to be clear on that issue of discipline. It's teaching. It's not yelling or reprimanding or hitting or punching. It's not any of that. My daughter and I, like I said, single mom from New York, Harlem, born, living on the south side of Chicago, so, you know, we always in Black communities. And of course, there's a system out there that does whatever it does. But guess what? We do whatever we do, too. So I have a book out. But my daughter, Patience, she's 12. She has a book out, too. She actually has a book series. You can go on Amazon and buy it. You can go to her website and buy it. She's a published photographer. Her book came out when she was 7. And the book was created because she wanted money. There's a lot of things going on in our lives at the time. But one of the things is she wanted to know why we weren't affluent, because we were in a neighborhood where there were very affluent people. And so she wanted to know, well, why aren't we affluent? And I said, oh, we can be affluent. I was like, let's just, what you want to do? I said, it's for you to become wealthy in the world, you just have to find something to exchange with the world, and it has to be big enough. And that's where the idea of her book came about. And so she did the photography, and I did the words to her images. I taught her how to do photography, of course. And so she has a book out now. The second book will be out by July. But what that is right there, everything I just described, is an empowering phenomenon that has nothing to do with anybody. Ain't nobody got power over me and my girl. What? I'm going to train her up. All she knows is her mom. She knows her mom with a 9-to-5 job, but she also knows me as an entrepreneur. And so her image of that and her reality about how you create wealth and all of that comes from observing her mom. So one day we were at a festival and she wanted to buy some silly string. And I was like, I'm not buying that. I don't feel like buying that right now. And so she says, I just sold 3 books. I said, well, girl, go ahead and buy that silly string, girl. Go ahead. You know, it's that type of power. It's a different tool that we usually don't employ in our kids. And definitely that her book is a project that we took on as a mother and a daughter. So it's the establishment of things that the entire family can create, so that even if we didn't have an empire to grow off of because our parents didn't provide, we can do things so that an empire is developed for them. And because of the age we're in today with internet and all these other things, we can do whatever we want to do. I just moved to Chicago September of 2014, and already I'm the founder of something called the Soulful Chicago Book Fair. This is going to be an event that takes up 6 or 7 blocks of Black authors coming to the table, being able to tell their stories. We're shooting commercials for them. How am I doing all this stuff? I'm a single mom. That's because that don't have nothing to do with nothing. And that's because don't nobody have power over me. I'm the creator's child. I do what the creator want to do. So even though there might be a white supremacist somebody, they ain't got nothing to do with me. That's their issue. They can supreme all they're talking about somewhere else. But their power don't have nothing to do with my power. I'm a melanated child. If you want to talk about anybody that's rolling and running things, it's the melanated child. The dominant child. What y'all want to talk about? You know, genetic, whatever you want. You know what I'm saying, but we have the power. But if I give it to somebody and I'm calling them superior, then that's me calling them superior. That's not my viewpoint. It used to be, but it's not no more. I'm the one who runs this show, and I'm the one who creates it. So I feel like that's the viewpoint that our children can have, And that's the viewpoint at this age with internet and everything else that we can create with comfort.
Okay, I have two more questions, really brief. Is there ever a time that you feel it's appropriate to use physical, contact and disciplining or rearing your children? Is there any time that you think it's appropriate?
No, not never. Not 1 minute, not 1 second, not one iota of a thought. No, because like for my daughter, I'm her biggest fan. But she drives me insane sometimes. Like right now, as I'm sitting on the phone, I am looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 socks of hers on the floor that she did not pick up. One pair might be from yesterday, one pair is from today. I'm sitting right here looking at them, right? Now, I could go crazy and be like, can I get there? Or I could just have a conversation about, look, here's a scenario, and we talk about it. I'm not going to hit her because of that, because what happens is, first of all, I need her to trust me. If you go out with a man and he punches you, your trust in that person or anybody who punches you or hits you, you don't trust them the same. You lose respect for them because they brought you pain. So I'm not going to bring her pain because I need her as my offspring to trust me, number one. When she drives me cuckoo-la-la with her behavior or her lack thereof, I have to handle that in a way where she understands my intensity, but she's not going to get struck for it. She knows that. She knows that. And you can see she gets upset when I say, look, now, I am not going to say do those dishes, not one more again. Now, if you continue on not listening to what I'm saying, you could kiss that little MacBook Air goodbye and your iPhone. You know, it's like something, just a negotiation. She wants her phone, she wants a computer, so she goes and does whatever needs to be done. But I absolutely have zero tolerance for hitting them, because once you strike them, you forfeit their trust in you. And they lose a little bit more respect from you, because they actually look to their parents for comfort and guidance. And anybody that hits me, like as a father, there's no way I want somebody to guide me that hits me. No way. Not in a million years. Because you bring me pain, so I'm not going to follow you. I'm going to follow somebody who brings me joy. So that needs to be the focus. Find a way to bring them joy.
Okay. My final question is, who do you think is most confused about racism? White people or non-white people? And that's my final question.
Oh, I would definitely say Europeans are more confused about it because they're the ones that are creating it. It comes from, we talked a little bit earlier about me being a Scientologist. There's a book we call Fundamentals of Thought, and it talks about, and it has a page in there that talks about the races and how for whites, to white people, if you're not white, you're worthless to them. And it talks about how they're more frantic, but we're more sane. And it talks about, for us, how we find significance in things in life, like a tree, water. These things are significant, and how to the white race, these things are not. And so in that, it's just talking about the behavior of the races and how for us, come on, we grew up with, you talk about us on the continent, seeing birth is normal. There's a book called The Iceman Inheritance by Michael Bradley, and he's a white author, but he talks about the origins of man, and he talks about the behavior and the resentment in European countries or in European environments where you didn't see birth all the time, just given the nature of the climate. There was a resentment towards birth because you didn't see it. You didn't, a woman giving birth is almost a jealousy in it, this whole dragging the woman by her hair type thing. But in our community, you can see it in the art. In our art, when a woman's breasts are out and being shown in art, she's usually feeding a child versus a woman laying on a couch naked being drawn. We're not spectacles to be, people want to take pictures of us naked. And that's a different culture. But for us, it's about life. It's about birth. It's about not being twisted when it comes to just nudity, and because it's just normal. So I would say that whole issue around racism comes from a people who don't have an understanding and a tolerance of culture and an appreciation for culture. We do have an appreciation for culture. It's one of the reasons why we open our arms for people to come down and land. We open our arms for them because, say what you about. Let me see what you about. We don't expect they're going to kill us and enslave us and treat us bad. because that's not what we're used to. But so when, to answer your question, that's how I see that. Racism doesn't come out of our emergence as a people. It comes out of some other people's stuff because they have a lack of an understanding or tolerance for people of color.
Okay, well, I really appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions. And thanks for taking
my call,
Gus. I will mute my line, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing your views.
Thank you for your questions. I love them.
Context of white supremacy. We have about 10 minutes. Folks, have any other questions you want to get into Ms. Asada Kirkland, do not dally. Get your hand up if you have questions that you want to make sure you get in. You do workshops where you work with parents and sharing the material that's in your book and just your views, helping to give them strategies to deal with their children. What are some of your techniques when you've got like parents who come in and they've, you know, got children that are 8, 9, 10 years old and they've been hitting them for that whole decade. And so now they're coming in and saying, you know, all right, I'm hearing your material. How do I go back and try to change this relationship with my child where we have already been doing one parenting style for a decade?
Yeah, usually what I do with parents doesn't start with how they are parenting. Because that's not really the issue. What I'm finding is that the issue is how they were dealt with by parents. And so that's where I start. They may have their own children, but we need to look at, well, what was done with us, because that's actually shaped the way we behave with our own children. And what I find is that when I sit with the parents and we do activities around what did they hear coming up, and what was their perception of that, or what were they exposed to when they were coming up? Man, I have everything from, I've seen everything from daddy, like I have them, in one activity, I have them illustrate their earliest moments of violence, as I mentioned in the film when the show first came on, or in the clip we played. But man, the drawings, I mean, they will astound you. You see drawings, mommy throwing a phone at my head, because I brought home a 90. Daddy beating up mommy. Daddy running after me with a gun. You see him running through the woods and daddy with a gun. Baby in microwave. Like, it's all of this stuff that's in the parents. And not only that, sometimes my workshops are with professionals, like social workers. And I have them do the same exercise and they come up with the same stuff. And I have to show them, you drew this, not your clients. So we have these things in our own selves as adults that never got reckoned with. Pain. I had one grandparent in one of my sessions. She started off very adamantly for spanking and justifying her spanking children. But when we got to her own universe and her own experiences, man, she was well into, she might have been 70, whatever. And she just started crying. And she was like, it wasn't even my fault. I didn't even do it. Like, she's crying, sitting there over her own experience in that particular thing because it never got handled and it never got dealt with. Nobody ever listened to her. No, and they didn't believe her. And here she is, almost 70 years old, and she's crying because of this situation. It hurts. It hurt that she wasn't listened to. It hurt that she got a whipping anyway. And it didn't have anything to do with anything. You know, so I basically work to repair. I call myself a parenting strategist because I'm working with the parents. I need the parents to, we need to heal the wounds that are in the parents first. And once that's done, I tell you, I kid you not, they almost always know what to do with their children thereafter. I have had all over the country, one woman from Texas sent me a message via email. She was like, because of you, when my son got in trouble in school today and he came home, usually I would have beat him. She said, but instead I took him in the room, I dimmed the lights, and I just held him and hugged him and asked him what happened. And she found out a whole different reality than just him getting bad grades in school. And she said, I want to thank you for that. And then another parent sends me a message talking about, because of your book, I no longer hit my daughter, and it's almost like her daughter was coming asking, why aren't you hitting me? Like she began to expect it. And she said she just started crying because she looked at her own life and looked at the things that were done to her, and she saw how she was duplicating what was done to her. So basically, when I do these workshops, it's really an opportunity for myself to work with parents to just, you know, no, this is not a big psychological, let's sit down and observe you. No, this is just, yo, what's inside? What's inside? Let's get inside and see what stuff is still sitting there festering. And usually when we find that, I never really have to say, now don't hit your kids. They already come out and know that. I had a brother, and he said, he was debating with me very hard about the spanking thing. He actually read the book, came back after he read my book and said, I need five more. I need to give these to mothers that I know, and I need to go apologize to my son. Just simple. You know, so that's what I did.
Wow. We had another person that dialed in. I just wanted to, because I think that's about the second time where you've talked about some of the strategies in terms of parenting and discipline, going and holding your child's face gently and just communicating with them. And this example that you gave about this mom who said, you know, her child got in trouble at school and she just turned the lights down and held him and asked questions, and even thinking like, because just from what I've heard over the years, I would almost be afraid to see if someone did a study, if they talked to older Black, and I'm sure this might even hold for other people, but I'm just talking about Black people right now because that's what we're focused on. If you ask them to write down the number of times that they can remember being hit by their parent and the number of times that they can remember being hugged by their parent, I would be afraid to see those statistics for this part of the world, just with what we have been subjected to and the toxic environment that we are in. The person that dialed in, last four digits, 0068, did you have a question for Ms. Kirkland? You should be with us.
Yes, I have a question. My question is, I have two questions. The first question is, do you analyze the way collectively Caucasians discipline their children, and if you do, what contrast do you draw between the way African Americans discipline their children versus Caucasians?
I don't really look at them like that. Like, it's not relevant to me, because the reality, because you could get real intellectual with all of this. We could get intellectual about the topic. If I looked at face value today, and I'd be like, wow, you know, white people don't beat their kids, but we beat our kids, but see, that's not real, because that's almost like you're not looking at history and being, you know, that ain't how it's always been. You know, this scene wasn't like, this is not the scene. Like, you know, this came from an environment where our kids were being beat by their grandparents. Like, you know, so some people are like, oh, it's not all white people. Look, I'm not getting into all of that. I don't really look at them, and I don't compare, because I don't. I'm not interested. You got different cultural norms we're dealing with. You got different sensibilities and how we communicate with each other. And there are just there are many things that are specific to us. So I look at us, and I don't look at us in the context of anybody else. I think in life as a people, that's what we do. We look at our state in conjunction to what they say or where they are or what they, and I'm like, I ain't looking at none of that. Where are we at? What do we want to do now? I look at planets out my window every night. I'm a derivative of the Dogon, who saw stars beyond them seeing them. They just found them in the 50s. My people have been seeing them for centuries. You know, I'm a descendant of that. So my thing is to look at that. I'm not going to look at the other stuff. Who do we teach how to use fire? Come on now. I'm not going to look at that. I'm going to look at the ones who taught the world how to be civilized. That's what I'm going to look at. So I don't look at other people.
Okay. The next question is, is your book to help kids become disciplined, or is your book to help parents develop a different way of disciplining their children?
My book is for parents, because there's not a book to teach kids how to be disciplined. Children mimic what they see. They're going to do what they are taught. And so the only way children, like I said, I taught at an alternative high school. That meant that these students dropped out of school and were coming back. And some of them were on house arrest. Some had three kids, some had six kids, whatever. So these were the ones who dropped out. So when I first started teaching there, when we had a little open, the beginning orientation, most of the teachers were saying stuff like, this is your last chance, you better get it right, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. But when I got up to speak, I said, I first want to say thank you, and that I'm honored that you all have me as your teacher. I said, and secondly, I want to say, if you're still here after all you've been through and you're still trying to get your diploma, then you're the strongest of those who have come through. Man, you want to talk about a standing ovation? You want to talk about the quote-unquote dropouts? Nah, kid, I didn't have no problem with them after that. And not only that, when I became their teacher, my thing is, okay, now how are we going to do this? I taught video production. I had a class called the Urban Census Project and what have you. But my biggest endeavor was I took them to Africa. Let's go. What are we going to do? We're going to have a classroom without walls approach to learning math and language arts and geography today. We're going to the continent. And so what that meant is y'all do this. We're going to sell nachos. We're going to sell Franks. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to raise the money. We got the kids their passports. They got whatever they needed, whoever's going to take shots, get they in, you know, the vaccination, whatever. And we got to go to the continent. Let's go on a field trip to the continent. Let me tell you something. The grades of my students who went on that trip shot so high when they came back to the States. It was unbelievable because they got to experience, they got to defy myths when they went to Africa that they're raised with about how black people are and what they're about. And so when they went to Africa and had a dynamic time, when they came back to the States, they were very strong and their grades shot up. And they were able to confront their peers who were like, oh, you went to Africa, did they try to eat you? And boy, my students let in on them students. And I mean, they really let them have it, but not in an antagonistic way, but in a way that brought some clarity about what it's like to travel and see brothers and sisters across the globe. And it was just a wonderful experience. So, you know, my thing, and I almost forgot your question for the second one because of, I love this little tangent of taking them out to the continent. But the main thing is just the what we can create in young people comes from us. It just comes from the experience we give them, no matter who they are. The disciplining, I didn't have to discipline those young people, was your question. I didn't have to discipline them. I just exposed them to something that was interesting. And so they brought order as a natural instinct. Usually they get out of order when they don't understand something or the teacher's just unbearably, ridiculously boring or some other thing, and they need somebody to stimulate them. So my charge to parents and to adults is be interesting and have some care. And when you show care, they actually show you respect. They don't show you a lack of discipline. That comes from, that's a two-way thing, you know, and usually their discipline comes from admiration. And when you think about who you admire, you have to be admirable to young people. You don't scare fear and scare respect into them. They respect you because they admire you. So my thing to adults is be admirable. Do things that are admirable, and then you'll have them at your beck and call with no type of antagonism.
Okay. I definitely agree with you on how you know, kids will mimic the parent. With everything you're saying, I do agree with. It echoes Amos Wilson. You know, I remember listening. He says that, you know, if your children are crazy, usually the parents are crazy, and if the parents are crazy, you usually have to deal with how they function in society that they live in. And so my last question is, I noticed that not all black parents are always receptive to someone else telling them how their parenting style is. So with that being in mind, how do you get the parents to buy your books, knowing that if you agree with that? But from my personal experience, it just seems like, you know, a lot of black males or females, as long as their parents, they usually are not really keen on being receptive to different parenting styles if someone offers that to them. So how do you get them to buy a book?
Well, one, I usually get in conversation with a parent because one of the reasons why people jump back or tell you, this is my child, this ain't your child, and all that, is usually because of embarrassment, or they don't want to be accused, they don't want to be judged or whatever. And so usually my communication with the parent is one where they're not made wrong. If I see them yelling at their child, I don't walk up and go, don't yell at him, don't yell. I don't say that. I walk up to them, I get in their space, and I say, Ma, I said, what you need? You need some help? You need me to help you? Like, I get into her world. What is it that she needs? And usually what I found is they say, oh, these kids are driving me crazy. And so I start getting in a dialogue with her. See, me getting in a dialogue with her takes the anger away from the child, and now we're getting in a conversation where I'm listening to her needs, and then she calms down some, and then we go from there. Now, in terms of people buying my book, one of the things I do, because 9 times out of 10, my people are not going to buy my book from me off the street, so I actually give it to them for free. And the way I'm able to do that, if you go on my website, there's a section you can scroll down on the front page called Train Episodes. And what I do is on the trains of New York or the buses of Chicago or whatever city I'm in, if I see a person with their child, whether it's a situation that's getting heated or if it's just a pleasant situation, I actually get in conversation with them and listen to the scenario. And if it's something looking like it's trouble, we talk about it. And then I say to them, if I gave you my book, would you read it? Because I introduce myself as, and I give them my card as a sister who wrote, and I tell them, I wrote a book for us as parents. So I don't make it a them thing. I say, I wrote a book for us as parents, because it could be challenging sometimes, and we got to know what to do. And so that already they are connected with me, because I'm bringing it to them, not like you, it's us. And so then I ask them, if I gave you my book, would you read it? And if they say yes, then I take it out, I sign it, and then I do a selfie with them, boop, and I put it on Facebook. So, you know, I tell them, if I give you this book, the only thing I want to return is a picture with you with it. Because somebody, what happens is people have started saying to me, I want to give you some money for train apps. I'm sending you $100. And I'm like, good, that'll cover 10 families. And so then I'm able to give the book out for free to people on the street so I can get the message out.
Okay. I'm trying to really think about any more questions. Okay, does when it comes to Black people, social, economically, right, do you find a difference in their behavior from children? Do you find a difference in the parents' parenting style behavior of the parent when, you know, one parent is making over, like, let's say $80,000 a year versus the parent that's living in poverty? Do you find differences? If you do, that's what they are, and then I'll mute my line now.
That's fine. I find that I love that question, because I always say, you know, when you look at other races, usually the more affluent they are, they don't beat their children. It's like the poorer part of the society may beat their children, but not the more affluent. But in the Black community, everybody hits their children. I don't care if you got a PhD or you on welfare. Look, they be like, they know what the symbols on my book are. They know, oh, I get hit with that. Or a person who has more money may do it less, maybe, but then maybe not. And you can watch that on Atlanta Housewives or anything you want to watch. With Black folks, socioeconomically, there's no division per se in the viewpoint that you can hit children to discipline. And that's how you know it's ingrained in us from slavery, because it permeates every socioeconomic level of our people. We believe that we could beat our offspring, and that doesn't have a bearing on it. If we're a little more affluent, we might have more of a conscience around it because we have more resources, so we're not as stressed. But I've seen all strata of Black folks believe in hitting our children.
Right on. Did you have time for one other question? We had a kind of late call. Did you have time for one more question?
Whatever you want.
Okay, dope. The person that dialed in, last four digits, 0889, 0889. Did you have a question for Ms. Kirkland?
Yeah, Gus, I tuned in kind of late, and I see that you all was talking about beating children, and I think she may have answered, because I think, you know, I was told that whipping the children, this goes all the way back to slavery, when our great-great-grandparents were whipped, they turned around and whipped their children the same way, and then they use the Bible again under white supremacy, that spare the rod, spoil the child type of thing. Mm-hmm. And also too, I've seen parents, like yell at their kids, and I just sometimes I'll stop them. I say, hey, these are just 2 and 3 year olds. They're just being children. They don't know any better. You know, they haven't reached that point. So I say, just kind of go easy on them. They're just acting like they're supposed to act, like 2 and 3 year olds. That's all I had.
All right.
Yeah, we definitely agree, brother. We definitely agree. We said some of those same points. I think for me, what I want from Black people, I want us to just simply love our children. And I don't get that enough. I don't see that enough. I see us say things about, oh, he got on my last nerve, he's annoying, and I want us to really look at this, because if you see it, it's going to happen, right? You say you believe it, you achieve it. Well, this whole thing about shut up, get out of here, don't nobody feel like being bothered with you, all of those things, when our children get taken from us in different ways, even ways we don't feel is just, whether it's from stray bullets and all this kind of stuff, I want us to really look at how we talk to them when they were here. How do we communicate with our young people before they got taken off the planet? Did we say endearing things to them, or did we say things that continually push them away from us? And we have to start showing more love and care for them in the ways that we communicate with them, so that they don't feel like burdens, so that they don't feel ashamed, so they don't feel untrustworthy, all types of things. We need to say things that make them feel powerful, make them feel loved, make them feel appreciated, make them feel happy. I don't see us doing that, and I don't see us even having goals to make sure they're happy. It's almost like we want them to feel what struggle is like and to know how we've struggled, and we want them to struggle like we struggled, and I need us to stop doing that and to empower them and let them be happy going into the future with power to take our people where we need to be.
Right on, right on. Catch some of that in the archives, caller. We touched on some of the things that you brought up with your commentary. Before I let you enjoy the rest of your evening and get back to patients, just the last, or one of the last chapters in the book you dedicated to Mama Gail. So I wanted to read what she had to share, and then anything that you would like to leave folks with. The website again is beatingblackkids.com, same title as the book. From Mama Gail, she writes, "My theory is to let kids live, let them do their own thing. Don't chastise them. Don't point the finger. Compliment them. Pull them to the side when they are doing something wrong. Give them positive feedback. Let little girls go out and explore their lives. Just let them know what's happening out there. Don't hold them too tight. If you hold them too tight, then when they get out there, they are going to run rampant. Let them be little girls and tell them everything that is going on. It's not always about pointing the finger at them. Sometimes kids act bad for a reason. Sometimes it's not the kids, it's the parents. What are the parents telling the kids? How is the household? What are they doing in the household? How are they living over there? That reflects on the kids. It's not the kids all the time, so stop pointing the finger at them." From Mama Gail. Anything you want to get in before we wrap things up, Ms. Kirkland?
No, I just want to say thank you for reading that, because Mama Gail passed away some years ago, and she was just a wonderful soul to be around, and I love that I was able to capture her viewpoint. I was actually a teacher to one of her grandkids, and I just want to say, for Black people, be responsible for ourselves. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world, and this show is about looking at white supremacy and the quote-unquote powers that be, but the power is you. It ain't nobody else. And I really want Black folks to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility for our own place in this world. Take responsibility for where we want to be, and then do the things that we really, really want. Creating fear in our children is not one of them, I know. But for them to feel loved by us, and for them to feel trust from us, and for them to feel like we are really in their corner, I need us to create that reality more. I want our children to be happy. I want us to be our biggest cheerleaders for our children. And I want us to admire them. I don't hear parents talk about admiring their children. I hear them brag when they get good grades, but you can't brag with them having good grades and then call them names afterwards. Like, find ways to really get harmony in the household so that the kids admire you and really can call you a hero. And remember that creating pain doesn't do that. So hitting them and yelling them, catch yourself, and find ways to bring harmony and happiness to your home. And you're going to find that the stress decreases and your opportunities will become larger.
BeatingBlackKids.com. Check out the website, get the book, a lot of great suggestions. Real pleasure to have you on the program, Ms. Kirkland. Hopefully we can do it. You said you had the idea already percolating for your next project. So whenever you get the next book finished up, we would love to have you back on the program to review it and continue the dialogue.
Sure. Let's get this thing rolling and get our power popping.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking time out from patience and your other projects to speak with us. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Please enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening, and we will speak again soon.
Thank you. Bye, everybody. Have a wonderful evening.
You too. Have a great evening.
Okay, peace.
Peace. Context of White Supremacy. Again, said at the beginning of the program, courtesy of Lauren Kress-Love, when I spoke with her, this was before she was a guest on our broadcast, I guess within the last 10 days, but she had nothing but praises for Ms. Asada Kirkland and said, yeah, you should definitely get her on the program ASAP. She has a lot of great material. She was really proud, big fan of her work. Glad we were able to get it done. And again, just mentioning her, the loss not just of Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, but her other sister, Barbara Kress-Lawrence, this past weekend, a couple days ago. Again, hopefully we'll be having some programs where people will have more information. So people are interested in trying to support her and the family, just excruciatingly difficult year thus far. Hopefully we'll have details so that folks, if you would like to chip in, support any way possible, we can have some details on how you can go about making that happen. I just had a quick audio segment. I wanted to make sure that I got in. As I said, I said it repeatedly with Ms. Kirkland. I think she did as well, that, you know, we were focused on Black parents, Black children. That's, you know, really what we were trying to address with the information in the program. And that's, you know, what her book obviously is focused on. Not that, you know, some of this doesn't apply to white parents, white children as well. It reminded me when I was doing my research and reading her book and checking out some of the different audio segments and what have you that she has online, it reminded me of a segment from, this was from the summer of 2015, where they were talking about, this is, I have a whole tab now in my browser on just the word discretion, and how that pops up so frequently in association with racism, basically where they're saying discretion, where you don't have to apply the same rule, the same standard every time, where the person who has quote unquote discretion, they can make their own choice about what they think needs to be done. So if this is an enforcement officer, I might have quote unquote discretion about whether I'm gonna arrest this person, whether I'm gonna give this person a ticket, whether I'm gonna give a warning. They have a lot of discretion about what power they're gonna utilize in that particular moment. There was a segment on New York Public Radio where they were having same dialogue about discretion, but they were talking about prosecutors, state prosecutors. And they were talking about how they're overwhelmingly white, and they actually did have one of the few Black prosecutors on, and it was just a phenomenal dialogue. But it reminded me, it popped up right with the discussion we had with Ms. Kirkland, and it reminded me of Adrienne Peterson. As I said, Ms. Kirkland, she did a lot of interviews back in 2014 when the whole Adrienne Peterson thing popped up. Again, this is a Black male football player. He's still in the NFL, who got into a lot of trouble because he had spanked his child and left some really bad bruises and welts on his young son's legs. I think his son at the time was younger than six. I mean, really small little guy. And people were talking about this like, oh, this is a disgrace. And I think on top of it, this was maybe, I think like weeks after the video of the Ray Rice thing had come out, where he had just savagely, viciously attacked his now wife. So it was just really, really bad. And oh, the niggers in the NFL have just run amok, and they're savages and brutes, and they just piled on. And it reminded me of this segment because I said, man, It's not that I think, not that I agree with what Adrian Peterson did. I'm in complete agreement with Ms. Kirkland about the zero tolerance. We should not be beating our children at all. That's something that needs to be like, whoa, man, we did that. That was totally incorrect. That is not the best way to parent at all. And I just look at the logic of it. She said this. I'm just repeating what she said. It would not be acceptable in any other relationship. If I have a disagreement with what you did, or maybe even you did something incorrect, let's even put it that way, this is not just a disagreement, you did something incorrect, it would not be acceptable for that to be, oh, now I get to put my hands on you because you did something incorrect. Outside of you attacking me in self-defense, something like that, it would not be acceptable in any other relationship except when you have a little person. Now it's acceptable that, yes, I can put my hands on this person because they've got on my nerves, or they did something incorrect, or they did something that I didn't want them to do. Just none of the logic just does not hold up for me at all. I think it's, in my view, obvious the connections to racism, white supremacy, earlier forms, what is called the slavery plantation phase, earlier phase of white supremacy, direct connection to all of that. So I definitely think they are different, better, not just different, better techniques that we can use to go about parenting. But in my view, the racist element of everything about the Adrian Peterson is that they put him up to say that, oh, black people are just terrible parents, and look at this, oh, poster child for abuse. It reminded me of this segment from months ago. This was this past summer. I think I played it on the compensatory call-in, but I just want to play it one more time just to underscore, because it's not that white children don't beat their children. They absolutely do. It just doesn't get that same type of attention as Adrian Peterson or other aspects when it pops up when they just want to focus on black people being horrible mothers and horrible fathers, and oh, we're just the worst, precious, if you want to throw that in as well. White people do the exact same thing all the time. I've said for years, they have no regard for children at all. You can forget whenever the anniversary for Sandy Hook comes up and they want to act like they're really concerned about you, but they have no regard for children at all. They wouldn't be dumping their little white urchins on black people if they really, really cared about children at all, even white children. But this is from last summer. This is black prosecuting attorney in the state of Michigan, Kim Worthy, talking about how racism, white supremacy, and white child abuse has played out in her experience. Quick sound clip, and then we'll see if any folks have any commentary before we wrap up. Context of white supremacy.
When I was an assistant prosecutor, this is before I was on the bench for 9 years, in between those two jobs, I had a police officer come to me, an African-American woman police officer come to me and said that the white head of the warrant division at the time, and this was a long time ago, would not charge these, just so happened that five of these cases were white women, and they would not charge them with child abuse. And they brought them to me. And at the time, I was in the child abuse division, and I looked at all five of those cases, and I said, there is no earthly reason why these files should be sitting on the desk of this prosecutor waiting, quote-unquote, for investigation, when they were all very serious, very prosecutable, very provable cases of child abuse. And some of them were extremely serious. And so I took these files to my then boss, John O'Hare, and I said, look, I am being told by this African, I thought race was an issue here. And I really saw that, but race was an issue. So I went to my boss, and I said, I don't understand, and the police don't understand, why these five white women have not been charged. That was a commonality between these five cases. And these were, like I said, horrible cases of child abuse. And there was just a reluctance to charge them because of their gender and their race. And I charged them all. He told me to go do the right thing. I charged them all and convicted them all. And in one of them, I got a jury verdict in 15 minutes. And so, again, that's when a part and parcel of who you are makes a difference. And if you have people who are not willing to give every ethnicity or every race or every, you know, both genders an opportunity in their minds to be able to do things that are wrong based on the evidence, then they have a problem.
Context of white supremacy. Again, that was from this past summer, just a few months back. I remember it for many reasons, really important segment where they were a lot of the things that they were addressing, but just that segment alone, just like most other things within the system of racism, white supremacy, the rules are for black people. White people go out, do whatever they want to, and they are just not punished. And again, I submit that that is not white privilege, that is white power, because it was white people powerful white people making that decision that they were not going to prosecute these white women. Anywho, just to come back to make sure that I'm very clear, as I said, I don't agree with everything that anyone says about racism, white supremacy, or anything else, but I am in complete agreement, zero tolerance for the placing hands on children. Just as she said, that should not even compute as a form of discipline in terms of raising a child. This is someone that you care about. I do not think it can be understated, the research that she presented in terms of beating a child and how that retards brain development and the impacts, the long-range, lifelong implications that that can have for a child. That should be considered, researched, thought about when people make their determinations about how they are going to interact with, quote-unquote, discipline their child. That should be strongly thought about. And she has in the book, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she has in the book, she has a whole chapter about planning for children and how frequently we do not plan for children. I was thinking last night where a lot of people, and I've seen this over the years, where a lot of people, they will have thousands of questions based on Mr. Fuller's recommendation that before you hit the bedroom, black males, black females, non-white people in general should ask a minimum of 200 questions so that you are very informed about this person that you're going to have sexual activity with. Frequently, that does not get to, well, what are your thoughts on having children? What are your thoughts on beating a child, quote unquote? What are your thoughts on how you go about disciplining a child? What are your thoughts on education? A lot of times it does not get to the childbearing portion. And that, I mean, is astronomically important. I think a lot of this, if we just reflect on our own lives, either as, you know, how we were born or if we are parents when we had children, was this a thought out process? Did we have, you know, lots of conversation and a plan, maybe years in advance? Okay, we're going to have a child. When are we going to have the child? What is the first 10 years of the child's life going to look like? Academically, what are we going to have them involved in? Diet, have we talked about discipline? Have we talked about corporal punishment or not doing? Have we talked about all of those things? I mean, really taking it extremely seriously. Dr. Welsing, what does she say all the time? When you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. And 10 times out of 9, and that's the way I meant to say it, it is not funny at all. Just my view. Certainly folks can have their own opinion, but I would again submit, and then if folks have any commentary they would like to share, I would probably be very fearful of seeing any sort of statistics. If folks just, you know, jot down how many times you can remember being beaten as a child by your parents, and then how many times you remember getting a hug from your parents. I'm not sure everybody, you know, would have statistics that are, you know, terrifying to look at, but I suspect there would be more than we would like to acknowledge where those numbers might look kind of bad in terms of, you know, what you can remember from your childhood experience. And I submit the people that are most to blame for that, racist man, racist woman, racist child, all of this is a result of being in a total system of terrorism. I think Ms. Kirkland emphasized that repeatedly throughout the course of the dialogue, as have some of our other guests. I mentioned Eric Grimes, Dr. Joy DeGruy, some of the other folks that we've had on the program who have discussed similar subject matter. But it's not about blaming anyone, just analyzing and making better decisions. You get better information, you get a better understanding of things, you can make better decisions. With that, folks have any comments they would like to get in before we wrap up? The folks who dialed in with the hand up should be with us. I guess I'll get, this person didn't get to ask a question because they dialed in kind of after our guest departed. The caller at 2800, did you have a question or a comment that you were going to get in? Last four digits, 2800. Did you have a question or are you just listening? Commentary, are you just listening? Last four digits, 2800. I guess they might just be listening in. Caller at 2800. Maybe they're just listening in, which is fine too. Let's see. The other folks who dialed in, if you all had any comments, questions that you wanted to get in before we wrap things up, you should be with us. Our caller in Michigan, retired firefighter, caller at 0068, and Thomas in New York, you all should be with us if you all had anything you wanted to get in before we wrap things up.
Yes, sir. I have a brief commentary because I've made mistakes with my own offspring, and I quickly came to the real. I didn't feel comfortable about even raising my voice to him, you know, very loudly. My mother would always tell me that my voice projects in a really hostile way, and when I used to see his reactions, I can see where it really didn't have a constructive relationship by dealing with him in that way. And here's the most important thing. I also have the privilege to work with other people's children on the high school level as a football coach. And by being a attempted parent myself with an offspring, even before I had a child, I was coaching, but certainly once I started being attempting to be a parent myself and dealing with other people's children, my coaching greatly improved on how I interacted with him, with them. They don't want to hear nobody yelling at them. And being that we're in a system of a global system of racial white supremacy, by the time that child gets to you, they've already heard everything of hostility towards them, not by strangers, by people who are right in front of them on a daily basis. So for me to come in and pile more of it, no matter what I'm saying, what the words I'm saying, it still is not going to, just like she said, like the guest said, that it's just going to bounce right off. It's going to bounce right off. And in some cases, nowadays, these kids are a lot more bold than what it was back when I was their age. They will come at you. They definitely will come at you. You're talking about a big old 16, 17, 18-year-old? I don't think so. So you better have an alternative on how you deal, how you constructively cooperate or discourse with other people, because you'll get the best out of the relationship. They will get something out of you, and you will get something out of it yourself. And that is what we're supposed to be trying to do when we interact with one another. And so I think that whole concept is very valuable. Last thing, even from the standpoint, you know, I mean, it's an extension of that. I went to college for 4.5 years, and some of us have the unabated goal to be a part of organizations that's supposed to be going about the means of helping people. But at the same time, we're beating on each other. I'm talking about some of these fraternities and sororities that we have on these college campuses, where you have people that are supposed to be at the ultimate level of learning, and this type of stuff be going on. You know, I mean, at Florida A&M a few years ago, we all knew about a child was killed. Well, I would say, well, an older child was killed, drum major was killed, literally for some foolishness, like, you know, of, and like I said, these fraternities and sororities, their main goal and objective is to help people. And you mean to tell me I got to take a whooping? I got to take a beating? And, you know, it just doesn't make any sense at all. You know, so those just some of my comments on it that we need to really improve on that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just in that vein, I think a lot of that fraternity and sorority, quote unquote, Greek life, as they called it, I think we picked up a lot of bad habits from racist man, racist woman, and racist child that need to be kicked to the curb. Because I see a lot of, same thing with Adrian Peterson. I see there's a lot of data that white people do a lot of that beating and all kinds of what they call hazing to people in the fraternity stuff, but they don't become the poster child for it the way that the Florida A&M situation did. But just, I agree completely. We picked up a lot of bad habits that need to be totally thrown in the waste bin, and let's pick up something that would be much healthier, much more constructive way of relating to other black people.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. This is Ross. I tried to chime in earlier, but I don't think you saw me in line because I put myself in the queue fairly early. But I didn't get to ask any questions, so I feel the subject is very dear to my heart because I'm a poster child for a lot of the abuse that she talks about. And I just want to put down for the record that I know I think it was a firefighter in Florida said, talked about never hearing stories about these village type beatings. I heard firsthand accounts of that, me being from the Caribbean, specifically Trinidad and Tobago. I heard firsthand accounts where relatives of mine would be beaten at school by the teacher. They'll go home, their mom would beat them. Then their father, when he got home from work, he would beat them. Sometimes they'll send them to the grandparents so they can beat them. I mean, I heard some serious, serious stories about serious beatings. So that's just me, of course, and I'm sure there's other people because I had a couple of other friends from other islands in the Caribbean who also had similar stories, and they would share these stories with my mom. And as I became a young adult too, some of my friends' parents would talk about these things around me. So that's something that did happen in certain communities for African people. And it was really interesting that she discussed talking to the elderly woman who started to cry. She was in her 70s when she actually walked her through her own experiences, because if it wasn't for my wife, I would probably be one of those guys who would have, my son would not be anywhere near the human being that he is now had I had free rein to basically abuse him like I was, because that was the mentality that I had. And it was my wife who actually said to me, you know, there's a little Ross that needs to be healed. And to hear her discuss the fact that she has to deal with the child and that elderly person, or the child and that adult who has the ideology that beating a child is okay. Because my wife really helped me unlearn everything. And, you know, I never touched my son. I was able to establish a relationship where I could have conversations with him and get him to respond. I actually incorporated a lot of African traditional spirituality in his upbringing. And he told me as he got older, that was very, very essential for him never telling us lies and him actively and consciously keeping out of trouble. And what I told him essentially is I just talked to him about our ancestors and the fact that we're here because of them. And this was very young. I'm talking maybe 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old. These were stories that I would tell him, and I would read him different African traditional stories and parables, Egyptian stories. And I talked to him about Tahuti, who is essentially the deity who created letters. And he's also the record keeper. And he basically keeps records of the lives of all people. And my son told me as he was a teenager in high school that those stories were the things that weighed most heavily on him. And that was what he utilized to stay on the right path. In other words, just him being aware that he was being watched 24 hours a day by his ancestors was enough. And just the implications for the afterlife as far as breaking the rules, as far as doing things that are not supposed to be done, these things had a heavy effect on his consciousness, and I'm really happy about that. The questions I wanted to actually ask her was, one was I wanted her to speak to the intergenerational aspect of beating children and how that comes from slavery, simply because what my experience was, I thought my mother hated me. Like, some of the beatings I got, I can tell stories that are incredible. And matter of fact, to this day, I don't do alarm clocks, because my mother used to actually wake me up with an extension cord anytime I slept through the alarm clock. So to this day, when I first met my wife, I actually, when we first met, she used to use an alarm clock. And I remember when we first stayed together in the same bed, and she had the alarm clock go off, and I literally shot out of bed like a bat out of hell and stood up at attention. And she was like, what's wrong with you? And then I had to actually recount these stories to her. And at that point, I remember she cried, and then we had a long conversation. And then from there, basically everything kind of snowballed where we would have these regular conversations. She would just ask me about my experiences, how these experiences made me feel, and how these experiences made me feel. And once my son was born, when I wanted to take the same approach, she did the same thing. And she just continued to ask me the right questions that really made me question my own approach to raising my son. And in so doing, we actually made a pact that we would not hit him and that we would take a totally different approach. And I'm thankful that we did that. And I immediately bought her book because I would love to learn more and actually pass that information in her book on to my son so he can utilize it with whenever he has children. He can utilize these techniques with my grandchildren. But I wanted her to speak to that intergenerational aspect because my mother told stories of being severely beaten by her parents. And in turn, I got a lot of severe beatings as well. And like I said, I was planning to do the same thing. Thank goodness my wife was of a different upbringing and a different mentality, and I was able to understand and gravitate towards that because I wanted something better and different than what I had. And thankfully, through her, I was able to facilitate that. And the other question I wanted to ask her was if she could speak to how parental beatings can actually foster behavior in gangs, because I know when I was a teenager, for the first time in New York history, we're talking like the mid-80s to mid-90s, essentially, but essentially you had teenagers that were terrorizing New York from high schools to colleges, and I was one of those kids. Sometimes we would end up in the newspapers for doing all kinds of things, and I remember it was Tupac who actually had the acronym Thug Life, which meant the hate you give little infants F's everybody. And I remember that, I mean, we would after school or when we would cut school, it would be sometimes 50 of us to 70 guys, and we would do crazy things. And all of us had similar stories of literally hating our lives at home. And all of us had similar stories of being beaten and all kinds of different things. We had people from the Caribbean and African Americans, but the experience was identical for the vast majority of those kids that we ran the streets with. And I wanted her to speak to how, and I know for me, my mentality, and I discussed this with quite a few of the guys that we used to hang with, was essentially I'm giving, and it was literally I'm giving to the world what was given to me. I didn't care. I had a very fatalistic mentality, and I associated that with my life at home, which was very untenable for me. I left home at a very young age. So I wanted her to speak to that. And then finally, my last question was in regards to her being a Scientologist, because she's the first Scientologist I've ever heard speak in the manner that she does. And I saw one of the most incredible documentaries on Scientology called, it was done by HBO, called Going Clear. It came out last year. And they actually interviewed people who were in Scientology in California. And literally, through this documentary, I learned for the first time that Scientology was literally the only religion in the history of America that literally brought the U.S. government to its knees. And they tell the story of it, and it's an incredible story of how they were able to gain the legal status of a religion as far as them not having to pay taxes. And they basically held the U.S. government hostage by filing, I think it was over almost half a million lawsuits. And the government basically said, if you cancel these lawsuits, we'll give you I forget what chapter is called, chapter 5 or something, to make them basically considered a legal religion and not be charged taxes. And I implore anybody to look at that documentary. It's mind-blowing stuff. Essentially, I just wanted to know if she actually saw that documentary because it speaks to a lot of some of the things that Thomas in New York brought up. And it also speaks to white supremacy in one of the most profound ways that I've ever seen. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Oh, for sure. I didn't, you're calling in, Rod. Good to hear from you, Raj. You're calling in from a different number, it looks like, than your typical number. Is that the case?
Really? No, I'm calling from my same cell phone, so I'm wondering if the white supremacists have tampered with my cell phone. I've had issues with that before, too, because of some of the conversations I've had on the internet and stuff. So maybe they're messing around with the cell towers, because, no, I'm calling from my actual cell phone like I always do. This is really interesting. What's the number that you show? At least the last four digits.
The last four digits are 2800, 2800. But yeah, it's
wow. I don't know what number that is. Wow, I'm fascinated by that. So that lets me know they're still on their job because, like I said, I've had some profound experiences because I've dealt with racism in the past and speak about it very actively. So this is a very interesting turn of events. Thank you for that. Wow. 2800. Okay.
Bob, send me a text message real quick and let me see what number pops up on my phone.
No problem. I'll send you one right now. Let me know.
Okay. Gus, good evening, everyone who called. I can't stand psychologists. I'm sorry. They just hurt me. The lady had a lot of good information. And I like some of the scenarios she used. You know, personally, I believe there's a difference between beating and abusing. You know, certain things you need to get discipline for. One thing that's intolerable in my house, my kids are fighting each other. Oh, no, that can't happen. You know, that stuff has to go. You know, y'all ain't going to be breaking my stuff up. Y'all ain't pay for no. Y'all got to, you know, get it together. Y'all both be mad at me. And y'all can stop fighting each other. I mean, just certain things that, you know, my son notoriously get calls from school. I mean, just doing stuff that you like, well, you just got in trouble for this. I mean, sometimes you just can't keep talking, and then you see a difference in the interaction that they may have in the situation after that. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, this definitely comes from slavery. But I know I was privileged, I hate to say privileged, but I went to high school and it was pretty much, you know, diverse, about 30% black, 30% white, and 30% Latino. And I never thought white kids got beat until I went to high school. I mean, the story they would tell, you sit there, you know, especially like football practice or something, and, you know, just talking, you know, and I mean, and still getting beat. Like, y'all still get beat? Like, yeah, I mean, you talk about abuse. So, I mean, I think that they're equal opportunities abusers, white people. I mean, it don't matter what race you are. They just like abusing us a little bit more. To speak on some of the other things that was mentioned, the hazing and stuff, you know, I never experienced hazing, and I wonder if the firefighter had any question on this because football camp was like hazing central. I mean, like, you know, I mean, as soon as you hopped off the bus, you had to deal with all kinds of abuse, you know. I mean, you carry the upperclassmen's pads, and, you know, you can't act out. I mean, people got taped to the locker. I mean, it was all types of, you know, people got rubbed down with, you know, held down while people put Bengay on their private parts. I mean, crazy abuse in that atmosphere as well. And, you know, that's all I pretty much wanted to mention. Cause, and as far as the fraternity thing, man, I wish that, especially in the black colleges, that if we're going to do a fraternity-type situation, because I can understand some of the hazing that goes on there, and to an extent, I mean, you're trying to gain somebody's, you know, trust or whatever. I mean, it's sort of like a rite of passage, you know, but I wish that we weren't Greeks and we would, like, maybe try to have a comedic, you know, a Egyptian, ancient Egyptian type of fraternity. Instead of being Greeks and Romans, you know, let's do something that's black. You know, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
I know on the hazing thing that reminded me of Richie Incognito, race terrorist in the NFL, who that was his excuse. I was just hazing. I forget the I think Jonathan Martin might have the last name incorrect, but it was a black male football player for the Miami Dolphins, also down in Florida. Back, I believe that was 2013 when all of that came out. But I think that was the excuse, that this was just a little good-natured fun, just a little tomfoolery, just hazing him because he's a rookie, and so we got to get our fun in, which includes all these racist insults and everything else that they were doing. My view, if there's going to be some rites of passage, I would hope, particularly if we're trying to do something constructive, this does not include an excuse to be putting hands on someone in a violent manner. Like, I'm sure we could come up with a constructive rites of passage in 2016 where you have to, you know, read a certain amount of books or do a certain amount, some certain number of hours of community service or, you know, something that is of constructive value. Certainly we can do something better than this is an excuse for me to bop you on the head a few times or take a paddle and beat on you, which has got some, at least to me, homoerotic undertones to it. Certainly, I think we could come up with something better if we're going to do all of that. And the football thing as well, because I think that's pretty common. I've even heard Kobe Bryant talk about how he was hazed when he came into the NBA by Shaquille O'Neal and some of the other people that were on the Lakers team at that time when he was a rookie. I guess that would be 96, where he's talked about it. It got so bad he had to go and get white people to get the black people to leave him alone because they were abusing him so much.
One more thing about abuse, too. Also, like, growing up in black neighborhoods, you know, like, there's a level of abuse, you know, I think Rod's trying to hit his games, but even if it's not games, you know, just a level of abuse, you know, to be down with the boys, you know, like, you're the young one, and, you know, and it kind of goes from generation to generation. And even with the gangs, like I believe in California, a lot of people have to get jumped into the gang. You know, all the other gang members beat them up for 5 minutes and getting their member, you know. So it's just a lot of abuse amongst black people in particular.
Absolutely. Lots of dysfunctional behavior.
Hey, Gus, can I speak to the fraternities thing?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I remember it's funny that Thomas in New York brought up maybe using an African-centered approach to fraternities, because I remember Dr. Ben saying that in like the late 80s. He like discussed that in almost an entire lecture where he talked about that. And I agree, it should be African-centered and it should be constructive, just like you said. And I wanted to point out that Mwebe Ishangi, he, on his website, he has a brilliant article he wrote called Mentor versus Jenna. And Jenna is basically the African variation of, I guess, what would be called in English a mentor. And he speaks about how the actual term mentor speaks to a homoerotic fascination with the buttocks and to actual homosexual sex between men and boys. And he actually talks about that's the reason he no longer uses that term. He uses the African term Jenna, which basically means like a teacher or someone who helps to basically teach young people and just teach in general. And he has a brilliant article on that. And also he is a former fraternity member as well. I believe he was in the Alphas, and he has a couple of treatises on that and the hazing and the abuse, and he also relates that to Greek culture as well in very profound ways and gives a lot of great information that if someone wanted to research and find out more information, they would be able to. And definitely what Thomas said about gangs is absolutely true. This was back then. This is when City basically had their own quote-unquote homegrown gang. So at that time, the Crips and the Bloods couldn't really set up any sort of shop there like they have now. And a lot of the times we linked up in high school, so it wasn't anything where anyone was jumped in. These were people who we dealt with every day. We were in class. Like I said, we would cut school together and do all kinds of crazy things we shouldn't have been doing. So it was a lot different then because everybody kind of knew everyone, and it was intergenerational as far as everyone being from New York City and having strong roots in the New York City area versus today, where we followed the example of the Crips and the Bloods, where people are absolutely jumped into gangs and things like that. So, yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there, too. Thank you very much.
Yes, just two things. When it comes to sports programs, they have to be very well organized and supervised. Because especially in the environments that I work in, for the most part, for instance, the team that I coach at, everybody on the team except for one child is non-white black. And everybody on the coaching staff is non-white black, period. So therefore, you have a lot of toxins just there by the system of racism, white supremacy. And you have to be very careful when it comes to things like hazing or something like that, because before you know it, the name calling will start, and it's bound to be somebody in that group that cannot just take what they're hearing from the name calling. Because for the most part, the name calling can cut deep. It can really cut into what a person is looking like, what they have may have said or did or something like that. And the next thing you know, the only retaliation that person has is to take it to a physical level. And then now you have all heck will cut loose as far as that concerned. And in my 31 years of being a high school football coach, I haven't seen where that was constructive at all. It had any constructive results as far as winning games, winning championships. And I've been a part of many championships, and that has never even counted at all. So I don't see the constructive value of it. And when as far as fraternities, I actually pledged a quote unquote Greek fraternity when I was a lot less conscious than what I am now. And I mean, but one thing I did understand was you're not going to stick that clothes hanger that you put on an oven. You're not going to stick that on my arm and burn some upside down you on my arm. I knew that was not going to happen. But nevertheless, and I can mention about all other kind of cruelties, because you never know. Once you have a contingency of non-white black people, especially black males, within that large group, under the system of racism, white supremacy, there's bound to be, if it's not well organized, there's bound to be some real sinister behavior that's going to exist between black people within that group. To whereas, I mean, during a time when I was in college, people were getting killed. I'm not concerned about what white people are doing. I know they're wicked. I understand that. I'm just talking about from the experiences that I had on how that is not constructive at all. And like I said, these organizations are supposed to be designed to help not only people who are in the fraternity, also it's every last one of them is designed to help non-white black people, period, whether you're in a quote-unquote community, other people at that college, or wherever. That's what it's designed to do. And so that, to me, doesn't have any place in it at all as far as physically or verbally, emotionally abusing another person, you know, at all. Nobody can justify that for me, you know, as far as that's concerned. Those are just my firsthand experiences out of those two particular institutions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I agree on that completely. We are pretty much at the end of the program. I will say, just since it was brought up about the Bloods and the Crips, I was reminded of John Patash. He was a guest on the program. Mbwebe Shangi, he was a guest on the program as well, repeatedly. But John Patash, in his first book, The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, he talks about, I guess, the dual aspect of it. Number one, that these organizations started as counter efforts against racism, white supremacy, to get some sort of protection from the abuse that was being meted out to black people in California. That's one. And then two, after white people took over and changed the whole focus of what these groups were about and made it very non-constructive and terroristic against black people, Tupac Shakur comes along and tries to change that again to get them to stop doing this and change, as I think Thug Life was mentioned, to try to change them to doing something constructive. And John Patash admits that that was a huge part of why Tupac Shakur was subjected to a lot of nefarious activity from white supremacist organizations that ultimately led to his demise, him being killed 1996, if I'm correct, 20-year anniversary. But that's, he's guest on the program. He has a documentary based on his book as well that folks can check out. That I was just thinking of that because I had been thinking about the Black Panther Party, and he connects, he just puts that all on a continuum, his mom and the work that she did, Dr. Feeney Shakur, and saying that they had been watching him for many, many years. That's what they do. They certainly have no regard for black children, that they had been watching him for many, many years, and just knowing what his mom was involved in and Assata Shakur and all of that, that keeping an eye on this one to make sure this does not look like he's trying to do anything constructive so that we can nip this in the bud before this gets started. At any rate, we should be here on Friday. We will conclude The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptist, with a lot of beating in that book, page after page after page of black people being beaten, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The compensatory call-in is Saturday, and we should have a white person on the program again on Monday. The white male who wrote the book on Virginia Christian, Forsaken is the name of it. It is a novel, but it's based on actual history, Virginia Christian, black female who was put on death row and executed because she exhibited black self-respect and killed the white woman that she was working for who physically assaulted her. But he'll be on the program this coming Monday. I played the clip before about his book. I know we have people that are Virginia residents who were interested in this case. If you want to take some time and do some research, you can do so in preparation, but he'll be here on Monday. If you have any other thoughts, comments, suggestions, gripes, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. I can say in closing, at least to me, it makes a lot of sense. In a system of white terrorism, if you produce a child, you know that child, unfortunately, is going to be in for years of terroristic abuse from whites and, unfortunately, a lot of victims. That's just what we have to offer right now. I think it would be best if the residents, while that young non-white person, that young black child is still growing and learning, to at least have, to some degree, a residence where they can come home, where they have people who care about them, who are not beating them and yelling, who are being very gentle, very kind, very inquisitive about their life, very caring. I think that's the sort of environment that black children definitely need and are sorely lacking right now, and have been for centuries, it seems like. That's what we should be striving to do, educating them, informing them about what racism is, how it works, but definitely making sure that they're in a nurturing environment to kind of replenish from all the damage that is outside that is just waiting to erode their black self-respect and tell them that they are nothing and ignorant and stupid and ugly and foul and everything, you know, nasty and evil in the universe because they are black, male or female. Just something to keep in mind. And again, these are the type of conversations people should be having, like maybe even years before you are at the point of reproduction, procreation, so that you have kind of a clear roadmap of how you want to go about dealing with your child. Think of Richard Williams. We did his book as well. Anywho, we'll be back 2 days. If you have any problems finding something in the archives, questions, gripes, comments, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks for all the folks tuning in. Hope you got something constructive out of the broadcast. Invest. If you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Again, massively important, sobriety would be best under conditions of war. You do not want to be behind the wheel if you're intoxicated, passenger, pedestrian, all of the above. Bad situation to be under the influence and get stopped by Darren Wilson, Daniel Holdsclaw. You really want to be able to make the best possible decisions to keep yourself safe and anybody that you might be responsible for. I would even discourage being around whites or non-whites who are under the influence. We already got enough problems. We do not need to be in an environment that is saturated with people who are probably going to make bad decisions. With that, we'll catch everyone in 48 hours. Creator, remind us to be patient with other victims of racism, other black people. Remind us, help us to be patient with ourselves. remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.